have come here with a fresh face, with an enthusiasm that cannot be denied. Beware. Be careful. Their promises ring richly in your ears. Our friend number six has a splendid record. He's adapted himself admirably to our procedure, but he has no experience whatsoever of the manipulation of such a community as ours. Beware! Has he got the administrative ability to implement his policies? Can you trust him?
Place your trust in the old regime. The policies are defined, the future certain. The old regime, forever. And the old number two, forever. Confession by coercion, is that what you want?
This is Bristol. It's Friday. Well, what time is it, folks? It's around about nearly 25 to 6, which is one of our latest starts, I'm afraid. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 5th of July 2024, streaming live from the Over the Arch at the Coomber Centre. We're called the Over the Arches Show this week, or basically feel like gypsies. I'm going to have to take a couple of photos of where we are, because we're in a corridor over the top of the arch at the Coomber Centre, because we couldn't get into the room that we were supposed to be in, and nobody turned up with no keys, so we just managed to get in through a window and set up here with our extension, our mixers, our laptops, our headphone extension and our microphone. So here we are, we managed to make it, thank God. The Coomber Centre is under threat of eviction right now by Bristol City Council, by the way, so it almost seems like the best place for gypsies to hang out for the time being. Bristol being ye olde Templar port in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex. Not to forget the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora and the Apple Store, not Google Play. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes, McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity almost. Well, it's been an interesting day today, what with the general election results from yesterday. So helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, or the Fourth Reich, whichever you prefer to call it, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and local, well, I suppose we could just call you freelance journalist, actually, because you're also working for the National Lottery. Are we allowed to mention that?
I'm not here, and I'm not using my National Lottery name, so no.
No, I bet you have loads of people come up to you saying, oh, we want to do a lottery application, can you fix it for us? But we're not going to say that.
If only that were true. I mean, the thing if I had the power, if I did that for myself, I still couldn't get it. It doesn't work like
doesn't
that.
Work
like,
no. So Don, is it Don or Donald?
Don or Donald will do.
Don Mac is joining us too to take us through. He's already been doing some other election commentary today, so we're going to be testing him on all the various figures coming out. So this week we have a whole load of other bits and bobs as well, though of course it's mainly election coverage. We'll be looking at the results of yesterday's general election with the landslide victory by Sir Keir Starmer, the Labour Party leader, who our very own Martin Summers here, our Labour Party member, voted to be the Labour leader. So Martin's obviously backing a winner there. But we'll also be going through some of the international news, particularly looking at Israel. And we've got a quite long interview, a couple of clips from that, with Michael Hudson, looking at the BRICS, because there are Eastern European countries who are in NATO and in the EU that are now trying to join the BRICS, which is the opposite financial bloc. Iranian and Russian news censored and cancelled in the UK. By the telecoms cartel, and then Ofcom, us, cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, and now from PRSC by the trans lobby. But we're still here, folks, even if it is half an hour late. Sorry about how late we are again. So let's just start by having a chat with you, Don. The first thing to note, I think, about this general election is that you've got a massive Labour majority, but actually less people voted Labour than in 2019. Yeah, so you've got a lesser turnout. There's a lesser turnout. Yeah. So what do you put this, people just staying at home, actually?
Well, yeah, I think that, well, it's a couple of things, really, isn't it? The former government made it their business to put people off. I think that was part of it. This is basically Rishi and his crew made it their business to put people off. I think that was part of it. They almost encouraged people to not come out and vote, but also they encouraged them by their inability to actually do anything positive, you know, affect people's lives in a positive way. So it just, can I say pissed people off? Can I say that?
Well, annoyed people.
Or peed people off. Can I say peed?
Well, no? They've annoyed people.
No, yeah. I looked at Tony's face. No, I can't. No, okay. So I will do a language check going forward. They absolutely annoyed.
You can scribble
it
on a piece of paper.
They absolutely. No, no, no. I thought we were, you know. Anyway, so I will be on my best.
Ofcom guidelines. I think you did work for Ofcom.
Yes.
For a while.
Oh, that. What's the time? So if any kids are listening, sorry, kids. And I apologise for my missed speaking, and on behalf of, and I take full responsibility for my own personal words.
So why is it that you think, how did this present government persuade people not to turn out to vote, where they did vote in 2019?
By their lack of ability. Well, in 2019, they gave people, I think it's fair to say, a reason to want to vote, which was the Brexit vote. 2019 was very much a Brexit vote. This time, there wasn't. And then on the flip side, who are now the current government, they weren't particularly inspiring either. So you got that dual factor. And everybody was annoyed with previous government and the current, or both sets, if you like, who were clearly, it was going to be one of those two parties that were going to be taking over the government. Only one of those two could win, and neither of them, one of them had, you know, disappointed a lot of people and made them walk away or walk in different directions, and the other lot hadn't particularly inspired. You heard that a lot. He's not as inspiring as Blair, is he? There's not a lot. Where's the hope?
Yeah.
You know, so it's that kind of thing, and it just slowly seeps into the psyche. So a lot of people didn't really feel...
I mean, my own take on it is that you had this swap year before last, with Boris Johnson being booted out and Rishi Sunak coming in, the polling rating for these people, these individuals, was totally different. Boris was, however awful he was with Partygate, he still had a very, very high approval rating. People wanted him to be in charge. I think, in a way, when it comes to... They did. Martin's shaking his head, but you're just ignoring the polls.
No, I'm not, Tony.
Because you don't want to. Yes, you are. He will in a moment, yeah. And you can keep stum for a minute whilst I give my opinion. And he was rating around about 40%, whereas Liz Truss and Sunak were around 15-17%, their personal ratings. So when the Tory party ditched Boris, they also did. And I think, in a weird way, people aren't... Although they're voting for a party, they're also voting for a king, you know, or a queen.
It absolutely
they're voting
is, yeah.
for a, and isn't there something
it's very
hard,
presidential
hardwired into people, whoever's in charge. And of course, what happened with the Tories is everyone voted in Boris, but then after a while the Tory party managed to arrange things, so Sunak was put in his place, who no one voted for apart from maybe people in his own place. But anyway, so Martin, this is the main thing, I suppose, for you is that you've been getting very, very irate, haven't you, over the low number of votes that the Conservatives had, and yet they won a big majority in 2019. Now the boot's on the other foot. Only about a third of the people voted for Labour, but they've got a whacking great majority this time.
Well, they got 37% of the vote, which would not allow them to form a government in any other European country. But our system is like it is, and because the right have now split decisively, Reform and the Tory... Last time, Reform... withdrew, if you remember. Farage took his people off. They were all ready to go. We'd been interviewing
that
loads
of... That
was
the Brexit party, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes. Well, that's right.
Yeah.
And, of course, that then made the Tory vote up. But once they come back into the game under first past the post, the right vote becomes split like the left vote always has been. And, therefore, you get a massive Labour majority as a result of this fruit machine of a system that we live under.
But it's not quite a fruit machine. It's a game, and some parties can play it, others can't. The small parties like George Galloway's Workers' Party that could have split the Labour vote, well, they hardly got a look in, did they? Even though they're the eighth biggest party, we saw nothing of them, nothing in the leadership.
I think the Liberals showed everybody how it's done. I mean, can you imagine that they got almost a record amount of MPs in on this time on such a much lower share of the vote than they did last time, because they did targeted, they very much targeted their money at specific seats, places where they came second, and they poured it in, and so they played the system. And it is the system. It's the system that we've got, and it's always been one of the.
Okay, so those Lib Dem votes aren't really Lib Dem votes, are they? They're Tory voters that can't bring themselves to vote for Labour or Tory. So the Lib Dems are there to capture those.
Yes,
yeah.
That's always been the strategy,
Martin.
Yeah, I mean, what the Lib Dems have done, they're finished in the inner cities and the big places. But what, because around here, Steve Williams used to be the MP, if you remember, and then he went into the Tory government, as it were, and people around here weren't happy with that at all, so they finished around here. But they've reinvented themselves for the Remain voting Tories, and there were quite a lot of them in places like Esher and so on. They also held North Shropshire, Liberal Democrats took it, and that's when Boris Johnson was thrown out, because the Tories have always held that seat. Since the Reform Act in the 1830s, and the Lib Dems took it because of the disgust with Boris Johnson, and at that point they got rid of him. The idea that he was popular is, it's a fantasy on the right.
No, he's popular amongst the right.
Yeah, it's a fantasy.
You know, it's like Farage.
This is a very, very right-wing constituency.
Right-wing.
And when they saw their own core vote Liberal Democrat, they started to panic.
Mm.
And of course, what's happened is the way it's played out. Is what the Liberal Democrats have taken the affluent suburbs that used to vote Tory. And they were not necessarily going back to voting Tory, because the Tory party looks as if it's finished now.
Yes.
The Reform Party are just going to cannibalise them. And that means they're probably, under first past the post, there'll be no right-wing government in this country in the rest of my lifetime.
Well, Reform have done quite well to come our way. We were hearing Paul MacDonald last week was on the programme from Reform, one of the candidates for North East Somerset, who helped unseat Jacob Rees-Mogg last night. He said somewhere between, I think he said 5 and 16. Well, he was on the very, very lowest edges of that. Reform have now got 5 MPs. They've come pretty much from nowhere.
Yeah, they got up to 5. There was one that was a dinner recount. They got that one? Okay.
Sinn Féin got 7. So who's a big political party?
It's interesting looking at the numbers of votes as well, because Reform did extremely well. 4,100,000 votes. Now, that is coming up around 2/3 of the Conservative vote. So the Conservatives got 100. See, this is how stupid the system is. The Tories have got 121 seats on 7 million votes, whereas Reform have got 5 seats on 4 million votes. So it's just, it really isn't reflecting the views of the country.
No, it's a lottery. Quite literally, and not the national lottery.
It's not so much a lottery, is it? Isn't it that the small parties are just shut out? Isn't that the idea?
That's always been the way in first past the post. But what the, as I said, the Liberal Democrats managed to do is to work out how to play that system to maximise it for their own benefit. And to a degree, the Greens did the same thing.
Yeah, so they have done very well. The Greens have now got 4 MPs, including here in Bristol, Carla Denyer, the Green leader, has unseated Thangam Debonair, who's been, she was actually being quite, well, she, for a start, there was a whole poster campaign here in Bristol saying that the 4 Labour MPs all abstained on the Palestinian ceasefire vote. Martin, I think that, you know, this is one of your things, isn't it, about this constituency in Bristol Central, used to be Bristol West. The vote is very sensitive to anything. If their MP doesn't votes against the war, that's fine. If they abstain or vote for it, then they're going to be out generally.
That's right. I would argue that this is one of the most radical constituency in the country. So the opposite end from Clacton, they have the highest Remain vote in the country right here. Back in the run up to the Iraq War,
Remain is radical, is it?
I'm just saying that that's a symptom of the kind of radicalism you're going to get round here, Tony, okay? Most people around here are Remain voters.
Are Remain voters, that's true.
They just are.
This is the most Remain in the country.
That's right. And it's also the most anti-war constituency in the country. So when Valerie Davey, who was the sitting Labour MP, did not vote against the war, people decided to vote for the Liberal Democrats.
What's interesting, though, I mean, the point that you're picking up, which is an interesting point, because in a sense you're both right. This is one of the most radical parts of the country, if not the most radical part of the country. But what that means is that I guess it's the internationalist side, which is why this is that it's Remain is an issue if you know what I mean. So that, well, that link to Remain is because the radicals, if you like, in inverted commas, are internationalists at heart.
So even though the EU is backing this feud with Putin, not quite so much backing the genocide in Gaza, but the EU have not been radical on any of these things, and yet we're still backing them, aren't we?
Yeah, but the point is that the Greens have won this. So the seat went from Labour to Lib Dem to Greens. So the radical voters are not necessarily loyal to the party they voted for last time. Mm. If they don't deliver, they boot them out. And, of course, the Greens, sad to say, are on board with war with Russia, as they are in Germany. It's absolutely ridiculous to my mind. I realise I'm in a tiny minority. I agree with Farage. We had the fellow last week saying what Farage had said. I go further than that, obviously. But, of course, most of my Labour colleagues are absolutely convinced that Putin's the new Adolf Hitler.
Well, see,
which is
the
absurd.
Thing is, can I just jump in? Because I'm not a party political animal. And it, to me, it's almost a plague on all their houses all the time anyway. But there's two different kinds of radicalism and internationalism. There's the political one, which is the political parties, which is the Greens, in order to play the game, have gone and joined in and all of that. And then there's the one that's the individuals, the people's. Internationalism, if you like, and on the people's radicalism, and that's all more organic, and it's based on interactions and contact on a day-to-day basis, people living and working and loving, as the phrase goes, with each other across Europe or across continents around the world. And the growth of social media and the internet that has brought people together, people have these connections, and they've got their own organic connections. Political parties, whole different ballgame.
Let's talk about the Workers' Party of Britain. The figures here are really crazy. They've got more votes than Sinn Féin, who get, I think, is it five or six, Martin? You might know this.
I think it was seven seats they got.
Sinn Féin, they get more votes, yeah, seven seats. But they didn't get any MPs, so they did extremely well. And I guess it's because they're fielding lots of candidates. So they got 200,000 votes. Now, the other parties around near them are Trade Unionist Voice, Social Democratic Party, Ulster Unionist Party, Alliance Party. These are Irish parties.
TUV isn't Trade Unionist Voice, if it's the Irish one.
No, it's
Traditional Unionist Voice.
Oh, yes. Unionist Sorry, Voice, yeah. Yeah.
These are Irish parties, right? So Alliance Party got one on half the vote of Galloway's party. So I think the lesson for George Galloway is focus on just a few, because he lost his seat, didn't he?
Or move to Ireland.
He's trying, I think, to... Well, yeah. But what he's trying to do is say, well, we've got a massive movement here. Let's... Because they stood in 150 constituencies.
Yeah.
And yet, if they'd have maybe stood in 10... They might have actually had
again some targeted play the system. I mean, but Rochdale was always going to go back, wasn't it? Because he slipped in because of Gaza, basically.
Yeah,
and the rows about it.
Well, Gaza hasn't sorted itself out by any means.
No, it hasn't. But Labour has changed its position and slipped through the middle, as it were. Again, the party political. View of a situation as opposed to the people's view of a situation.
Now, we've been talking quite a lot about numbers of votes and public proportional representation. And do you want to just both give us your views on whether there's any benefit in first past the post? Some people say it provides strong leadership. It helps the party to, you know, who the prime minister is going to be generally at the day of the election. You don't have to have a long protracted. But the PR results, I've got some of the what would be the PR results if we have proportional representation here. And it'd be interesting to see what you, before I read them out, what you actually think of the system.
I've heard some analysis of PR, and the key one is it depends what form of PR that you're looking at. I am generally in favour of PR, personally. I'm not a big fan of first past the post. Brexit is the kind of proof in that pudding. So I would like to see a form of PR, but however, I think it for me, if you're going to do PR, then you've got to link it to constitutional reform in general. In particular, I'm thinking about getting rid of the House of Lords as it currently exists and stands, and you're going to have to come up with a new system. Well, so some mixture of, for me, in the end, it would be some mixture of probably first past the post.
That's a whole other question.
Mixed
isn't
up. Well,
this massive idea. Well, because there well, may well, be some big constitutional. You may get your constitutional changes with this.
Well, the
big
thing
majority.
Is, Keir Starmer has exactly right. Keir Starmer has the majority to do that. It's whether he has the wherewithal, because basically any party that gets in on the first past the post tends to think, hey, that'd do us. We're all right, Jack. And it's a shame, because actually they've missed. Blair missed the opportunity, and now the Tories are never going to do it. But
well, Martin's a Labour Party member, but you are in favour of proportional representation. Are you suicidal?
I told. Sorry.
Well, because as we've just heard from Don, if we were to get PR, then the Labour Party would stand far less chance of having a cracking majority like this. You're not going to stick the knife.
Yeah, but
in
the problem with the cracking
majority,
the problem with the cracking majority about this is, in order to get it on 37% of the vote, you have to give up any radical principles. What I said to Corbyn when he was standing to be the leader of the Labour Party, I buttonholed him in the Malcolm X Centre and I said, "Why don't you do what they did in New Zealand, where they had a Labour government that wasn't doing the right thing?" And they had a referendum on PR. Mm. The left of the Labour, New Zealand Labour Party said, "We're not going to try and change the leadership of our party. Mm. We're very unhappy with the direction of travel. What we're going to do is we're going to knock on every door in New Zealand and have a referendum on PR."
So if
it's
Corbyn,
a small country,
if Jeremy Corbyn had stood in 2017 with that as part of his ticket, PR,
yes,
do you think
then
would have done
the,
well.
Then, yes, because in actual fact, you can then put
and lots of the minor parties
would have rolled in behind that.
Well, the minor parties would have been voting for
it. Exactly, they would have all rolled in behind that.
And you could then have your core radical principles represented by the Labour vote, and then you've got to compromise them by talking to the Liberals or who else.
Let's just look. I mean, 400 and whatever Labour MPs in any parliament means that there's a significant proportion of the population that are not represented by our current parliament. If you've got too many of one particular type, you need to take a few away and sprinkle it around some of the other people, some of the other communities, and views and beliefs. And unfortunately, that does mean that some of the more right-wing people will get in, but it also means that some of the more left-wing people will get in. And so, and in some ways, some kind of balance may be there. Can be afforded, but I think a majority of all of that, you want people. We're a very diverse country, and our parliament should represent that diversity.
Yeah, and it doesn't really, does it?
No. especially not with a super majority.
With so many,
I don't want to use that term. Oh, my God.
Yeah, but so many of these small parties now shut out, aren't they? Completely shut out.
Yeah.
Including, a party that's got nearly a quarter of a million votes, George Galloway's. But, I mean, this to me is just totally wrong. At least the Democratic Unionist Party's got its five representatives in there. The Greens have got
a lot.
No, the Greens have gained
No. The Dups, the Democratic, the DUP, they lost.
Oh, they've
three.
Lost three. Three. Yes, they have. Lost three. But they're still at least they've got. But you've got a party that's Galloway's party's got more votes than the DUP, but they're no MPs. The Greens have at last started cashing in because they always get a high number of votes but few MPs. Now four.
You bring it up. I just want to switch to the American system where the Democrats get far many, many votes, but because of the electoral college system, our system is not an electoral college, but in a sense, it can lead just like that, lead to a skewing of the votes. So, there needs to be something about the percentages of people, because the comparison that you're making between George Galloway, whose party was campaigning on the United Kingdom or Great Britain, and the DUP, who were campaigning in Northern Ireland, is a little bit apples and pears, because although it's all Great Britain and Northern Ireland, or all Great Britain rather, there's much less people on the island of Ireland in the north, if that makes sense, as opposed to campaigning across the entirety of England or the entirety of England, Wales and Scotland. So there needs to be some way of taking the percentage, the national percentage, and divvying that up. And that's why I say there needs to be an element of proportional representation in our system, as well as maybe a mix with first-past-the-post. I mean, in Northern Ireland, and it's happened for the first time in 50 years, that there isn't a Paisley who is now a member of parliament. Now, this is not a royal or a lordship where you can pass your title on, yet with safe seats like this you can, and that's why you need another way to avoid or to work around so that you can have safe seats, but then you need to be able to let people in those constituencies that are deemed completely Tory, completely whoever. There are people there that are not from that party. Having Boris Johnson or any other MP, and Keir Starmer did it as well today, say, well, I represent those that didn't vote for me as well. Yeah, you say that, but you never actually do.
No, they don't. They never do. In fact, they don't necessarily represent the people that did vote for them.
That's true too.
So look, 170-seat majority. This is a massive, considering they've only got about a third of the vote, as Martin was pointing out earlier. That's the majority that they've got. They're going to do a lot of things with this, I would imagine. Martin, do you think we're going to be looking at all sorts of constitutional changes, the sort of thing the Labour Party have been threatening? Because this is a very different, let's be fair, this is a very different Labour Party that stood in 2019 and 2017. And many people will be saying, well, it's because of the fact that the whole party's moved to the right, they've purged the party of all these pro-Palestinians, that's now why they've been so successful.
Well, they've been successful because they've concentrated on winning the swing seats that you have to win under first past the post.
Well, surely they've just been successful in getting loads of funding. We've got one of the powerful pro-Israel people.
Pro-Israel oligarchs who've given them loads of money.
This week there was an expose about the guy who was behind the demise of Corbyn, giving, like, literally in the last couple of months, £500,000 to the Labour Party.
Well, that's right, because there are two major... Obviously, first past the post is a system designed to keep the oligarch in power. That's why, and also the money involved, especially in the US, is ludicrous. And of course, you've got a situation now around the world where, you know, Putin won 80% of the vote in his country. Whoever wins the American election will never win anything like that. And of course, frequently, when the January the 6th thing happened in the US, they were protesting against being cheated in the Electoral College. It was clear, and it was clear when Hillary Clinton stood against Trump, that the Democrats got more votes, but because big Democrat states only get the same kind of weight within the system as small states, it's all rigged against anybody who's an insurgent. And it was designed by the founding fathers in the 18th century. We don't want too much democracy with all these poor people voting for stuff we don't want to give them. And it was designed like that, and it's set in stone that they can't change it. Russian democracy, on the other hand, has evolved very quickly from a shambolic state in the 1990s when everything in Russia collapsed. Don't forget, they've never had a democratic system. The last democratic election in Russia was the election to the Duma in 1918, which the Bolsheviks then dispersed. They've never had a democracy, but because they come to it late, they use the latest models. So they've got a proportional system with a full spectrum of parties from far left to far right. Mm. And they've also got presidential elections are like in France, where you get a first round
Martin,
and second
round. What you're
round.
Describing here is a tug of war, really, between the population and the oligarchy. The oligarchy want a system which elects them. The population want a system which actually represents them.
That's true, and that's the struggle, isn't it? It's always been the struggle, and it still is.
Anyway, let's have a listen to Sir Keir Starmer on the steps of Downing Street earlier on today, giving his the first half, anyway. We can't break it up into two halves, and in the middle we'll talk about some of the implications of this election victory of the Labour Party, which was totally predicted. In fact, on this programme, about a year and a half ago, when we had one of our guests saying the Tories don't actually want to win, and maybe we can discuss that a bit later, why someone might decide we don't actually want to win. We want to hand this over to the other side. But here anyway, here is Keir Starmer's, the first part of his victory speech on the steps of Downing Street earlier today, happily not being rained on.
Good afternoon. I have just returned from Buckingham Palace, where I accepted an invitation from His Majesty the King to form the next government of this great nation. I want to thank the outgoing Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. His achievement as the first British Asian Prime Minister of our country, the extra effort that will have required, should not be underestimated by anyone. And we pay tribute to that today. And we also recognise the dedication and hard work he brought to his leadership. But now our country has voted decisively for change, for national renewal, and a return of politics to public service. When the gap between the sacrifices made by people and the service they receive from politicians grows this big, it leads to a weariness in the heart of a nation, a draining away of the hope, the spirit, the belief in a better future, that we need to move forward together. Now, this wound, this lack of trust, can only be healed by actions, not words. I know that. But we can make a start today with the simple acknowledgement that public service is a privilege, and that your government should treat every single person in this country with respect. If you voted Labour yesterday, we will carry the responsibility of your trust as we rebuild our country. But whether you voted Labour or not, in fact, especially if you did not, I say to you directly, my government will serve you. Politics can be a force for good. We will show that. We've changed the Labour Party, returned it to service, and that is how we will govern. Country first, party second.
So that's new Prime Minister, no surprises here, Keir Starmer, with his whacking great 170-seat majority on one-third of the vote. Martin, I haven't heard you complain about that yet, but you were doing
it all
the way through.
Well, no, I do complain about
it,
actually. I do, because it creates a problem. Because ultimately, you haven't got a mandate. Yeah, Putin's got a mandate. He hasn't. If we go to war with Russia, that's what he's going to point out.
He will claim a mandate, and he will do it anyway, won't he? He will just pretend he's got a mandate, exactly as Boris did, in fact. So it's certainly an interesting, I think, fascinating system. 500,000 fewer voters Starmer got than Corbyn in 2019, largely because less people came out to vote on all sides. But this is interesting, isn't it? I mean, and yet he's got a massive majority where Corbyn didn't. I mean, I think most people will analyse this, saying that one of the main reasons Corbyn did so badly in 2017, particularly as he had a bit of a surge, was that his own party, your party, was, and people like Keir Starmer, who you voted to be the next leader, were actually working against Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, of course they were, and that's the battlefield you're on. The other thing that's happened this time that didn't happen last time is reform came back into the game, or Brexit Party as it then was, and the Tory vote split.
We've said that before, but Starmer's Labour got 500,000 fewer voters than Corbyn did in 2019.
That just shows how rotten the system is.
Yeah, I mean, surely it's up to the voters if they want to bother to turn out. So the reason that people didn't is because they got two appalling candidates. They think, I'm not voting for either of them. And they say, stayed in and, maybe watched TV or did whatever they did. Go out to the shed and repaired something because they thought it was more useful than going out to vote.
Complained, why isn't there football on tonight? Yeah. There's. I mean, in the end, I don't want to get down into, and I'm not saying anyone is doing that here, in terms of victim blaming, i.e. the electorate. When I did the show earlier on, I was saying thank you to those that did go out and vote. There is an issue about people being disillusioned, and in relation to your first question to me, about the people that came out to vote or didn't come out to vote, and the proportion of people, and this is a big issue, and I think personally, I put it down as an educational one, and I put it down to social media and the mainstream media too, are all playing their part in helping to turn people off. I nearly swore again, so I caught myself.
Yeah, so the vote totals turnout lowest for 20 years. This is an obvious sign, as I just said, with the Labour getting 500,000 fewer voters than Corbyn in 2019, which I'll say again. It just blows my mind that Corbyn, that there's less half a million less votes now, and yet they've got a massive majority. You have to go back to the 1990s, early noughties to get such a high turnout. So people are just getting disillusioned, walking away from politics, Don. Why?
Yes.
Why?
Why? Because partly social media, it's pushing people apart. Partly the educational system, it's people making people not aware. I'm amazed at the low levels of interest by so many people.
But why is it amazing? Because surely politics is less important than it was. When you've got big budgets and you're actually able to change things for the better, politicians now always seem to be, right, what's the next cut going to be? And that's why people have walked away.
That's partly... Yeah, I think that's more a symptom rather than the cause. I think I'm going to say it in that way. Because the thing is, in some ways, the less money you've got, the more important it is what you do with the money that you have. Because it can make a real difference to people's lives. And also, in our lives, we can see the differences. For example, the two-child policy. There wasn't one, now there is one. There's a restriction. And we, in living memory of so many people... Now, something they had has been taken away. Tuition fees. In living memory, something that we all had, free at the point, regardless of your age, you could have an education free. Now you have to pay for it. And now you've got students, we're racking up, was it 91,000 pounds debt after studying for 3 years? This is ridiculous. So, because there's less. Housing, same thing. So, yeah, the less there is, in a sense, the more important the decisions that are made.
These little parties have made a massive difference because lots and lots of people have been voting for them and then having no effect because the votes are then thrown away. So, Martin, Labour's vote share is the lowest ever to have apparently have secured a majority. So, because lots and lots of people have been voting for the little parties, even the ones that have been bothered to turn out, and those votes are then wasted.
Can
so
I ask,
they've got
can I ask you a quick
they've
question?
Got two-thirds... of the MPs, Martin, on one third of the vote.
The way the system worked in the past is the Tory party was a monolith and they weren't split. And therefore, the progressive forces split between Labour and
the left is traditionally having a fight with
itself. Traditionally having
constantly.
A fight with itself the whole time. And under first past, in other European countries, that's not a major problem. Everybody just votes for what they want, like in Spain. And there's generally a pretty even split between the left and the right in most European countries. But in most European countries, that is then settled in by negotiation after the vote. You know, the Workers' Party would have been in that negotiation if it's Spain. But it isn't. But of course, that still only works for the Tories until they split. And in the 19th century, they split twice, once over the Corn Laws and then once over imperial preference and free trade. And when that happened, they were out of power for a generation. We're in the Tories and Reform are going to be out of power for a generation under first past the post.
With any luck.
Well, I agree.
So the question I was going to ask is, and I think I'm right, prior to Brexit... The amount of voters, people voting, the size of the vote was going down.
Drifting downwards, ever
quite
since
dramatically.
Since the 1970s.
That's right. It's been a slow drift.
Through
slow
the Thatcher
but
era.
Drift,
through
a
the
slow
Blair
but steady
era,
drift down. Brexit rejuvenated and changed it. And then it jumped up. Except that the current political system, all of the parties except the SNP, I think, were saying, well, it's a done deal for now. At least, so Brexit is off the table as a discussion point. So now the voters are drifting away again.
Starmer is promising service; he's going to serve the people. But the thing is, he can't, can he? Because he just doesn't have the money to do it. And Rachel Reeves hasn't got the imagination to find the money to do it. I mean, this seems to me that there's all sorts of things need doing. We need to rejuvenate education. We need to rejuvenate. Public housing. All these things are going to cost a lot of money. There's also the possibility of bringing various things back into public ownership. We've got the whole situation in Port Talbot with thousands of people being put on the dole. Will, Martin, maybe you can answer this. Do you think that the Labour Party will be able to do anything about any of these? Will they have the imagination to be creative with the Treasury?
The simple answer to that is no. Rachel Reeves, clever as she is...
Is she?
Well, she's brainy. She used to work for the Bank of England and stuff like that. She's very much an establishment figure. But she came out some months ago now saying, with the usual rubbish, there is no, what did she say? We've maxed out the credit card. Now, that is absolutely intellectually indefensible. That's the sort of thing that the Tories were saying, but the national economy is not like a credit card. They could, if they wanted to, and we did do it during the pandemic, you just spend what you need to spend and you find it from somewhere. Either, of course, you've got to raise taxes, yeah? on wealthy, in the top rate of tax in this country. I repeat this every week on the show.
I tell you that these wealthy people have got their money offshore.
Yes, I know, but in the 90s, I'm just pointing out that in the 1950s...
You can't get it. You can't get it.
No, in the 1950s, though, the top rate of tax in this country was 95%. In the United States of America, it was 96%. And the roof didn't fall in. We had a very successful three or four decades after that. But it's dependent upon the rich paying their bit.
I suspect, you didn't ask me the question, but I suspect that they have a plan. I've heard, and it's been flagged a few times, that there's going to be free housing policies issued next week. Mm. I think they're going to take the American approach and go for the infrastructure and get capital money in and say that that's not borrowing in the traditional sense. It still takes in the point that Martin made. It allows them to skirt around it. And... be honest, it's credible because it isn't the same money, because it's for capital, so it's investment in the future.
Well, this is the first good news I've heard today, because I feel like maybe things are going to get a little bit lighter. Some of the things that need to be done by a central government to make people's lives better, particularly people who haven't got much money, may actually happen.
I think they've been a bit smart. It's that thing about under-promising, you know, and they just kept it. Every time they said, well, we're going to stay within that, we're not doing that, that's not in our plan. They when you looked at them talking, and it's not often that I would say this about any point, there's a kind of a smug, I know something that you don't know, look about them. I'm hoping, and it's just a hope, that smug look is, well, you know what, we're going to follow the American model. We should have done it. We should have done what Obama did after the crash. So let's do it now on a smaller British thing. The Great British Energy, that company, that's part of that. The Green Plan was, again, part of that. They pulled away.
Let me just bring in, hang on, because look, we had a Bristol Energy Company, didn't we? It was a total disaster.
Well, yeah.
Something like £50 million down the drain. Mm. So I suppose if you do it on a national scale...
Well, all this is supposed to be a company that's going to organise the leverage. They're not actually going to be for the capital, for the wealth... Was it the people, the wealth creators, the corporates, to put their money into different schemes that can benefit us all? So we'll see how that plays out. And I'm not putting all my eggs in that particular company's basket, but basically the approach, I believe, will be to develop the country's infrastructure. You know, when they throw in thinking, oh, we're going to do the potholes, that's infrastructure, right? You know, we're going to fix the transport system. That's infrastructure, housing, infrastructure, free housing policies in a week.
So our new king, it was Charlie.
King Starmer.
I do think of him as a king. I mean, when you get a particularly, you know, all the emphasis is put on the leader, then it starts to feel like that. Yeah. His majority in his own constituency has been halved from 22,000 in 2019. Martin to 11,000 this time. So his own people don't really like him.
That's
do
because
they?
Andrew Feinstein was standing against him.
I don't think he got anything like 11,000 votes.
It made a dent.
It's not done. Yeah. Taking 11,000 votes off him, has it? Has it?
I don't know. I don't know all the figures. Tell me, I've been at work all day.
Let's go back to the figures. As I said, I think the general thing is the trend, national trend. Where we started from is that, you know, people are what's that phrase? I don't know how many times I've heard it over the last 4-5 years, but if I had a pound for every time I heard it, I'd be a rich man, a plague on all their houses. What's the difference between all of them? This narrative that's just been pushed and pushed and pushed, this is the result. People are turned off voting. It's absolutely the result. And we've, in a sense, gone back to where we were before Brexit with the downward trend. So I'm not going to get too caught up in the actual percentages of the votes. However, the political parties that are out there, particularly Farage and his lot, will use this. Absolutely, they'll use it as a weapon to say we need PR, which we do. I just don't want a PR system that
allows Farage in.
Well, it's inevitable that he's going to be allowed in. Yeah. It's inevitable that he's going to be allowed. It's got to be. Look, they're a voice. They're out there. Agree with them or disagree with them. You said you interviewed reform people.
Yeah.
So you believe in everyone being able to, have a voice. They exist. You can't, if you don't engage, you're never going to deal with it. So they need to exist.
Actually, it was very interesting
that you say that, because if Farage does come out in favour of PR, that creates a sort of interesting alliance potentially about that between the left small parties and the right small parties, and therefore it might come about. But the problem is with first past the post, Starmer really doesn't have to worry about anybody toppling him anytime soon because of the strength of his majority. What may upset all of the apple carts is events, dear boy, events. There's a big financial crisis in the wings, and there's also the war, which is raging as we speak across Central Asia into North Africa, in Gaza, in the Ukraine, and of course in the Red Sea, which is having a big impact. This is not going to be a steady as she goes government. They'd like it to be, but the international situation, international capitalism, is in a total crisis, and therefore tinkering will not
do. There's something like 15 candidates standing in Starmer's constituency. I think it's because people like to sort of stand against the guy they think is going to win.
Do they know they're going to be on TV?
Well, it's partly that, yeah. But it's also this silliness of the principle that if it was PR, it might make a difference, but because it's first past the post, it doesn't. But anyway, the point here is, if one or two of them hadn't stood, like, actually, Martin, you did extremely well. Andrew Feinstein got 7,000 votes.
How many did he get?
7,000 votes. So,
okay.
Starmer's majority is 11. So if you add together the Andrew Feinstein, whose Workers' Party, I think he was standing for.
He was independent.
Right. And Andrew Stansel, who was standing for the Green Party, Starmer loses.
Well, yeah, there you are. So even in his own constituency, if there's a proportional vote, he wouldn't be an MP.
Oh, God, isn't it crazy? Feinstein hadn't stood. Well, I don't know.
That's very significant, isn't
yeah.
it? This is what the problem is.
Well, it is a bit if and but-ish, though, isn't it?
I mean, yes, so I know,
what about?
I would have liked, I would be hilarious if he won. The Labour Party had won 170-seat majority, but Starmer had lost.
That would have been great.
Can I just make a comment about PR?
Very interesting.
The PR system I favour is what they do in Ireland, where they have three constituencies are linked. And in that constituency, you've got three MPs to vote for, or their TDs as they call them, and you've got to put them in order of preference.
Mm.
Yeah. So what generally tends to happen, so it's very rooted, it's not like a party list system. Yeah. They can't just parachute people in. They've got to be local, and they've got to have local roots. But what tends to happen is you get one Fine Gael, one Fianna Fáil, and one other, which could be Sinn Féin, Green, or whatever. And it works. It's a very effective
system.
You see,
with the silly proportional system, sorry to call it silly, but over in Northern Ireland, in Southern Ireland, you've got the Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil coalition. So it's almost like Labour and Tory
have got
together in order to keep Sinn Féin out.
Well, that's right. They've had to.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't do that, there's going to be an election in Ireland.
I mean, surely the idea is Sinn Féin, as the largest single party, should be having an alliance with one of the other two.
Well,
the other two have got together to shut them out.
That's right, because there's historical reasons why these three parties exist.
It's absolutely the establishment shutting out the smaller, new...
Well, they're not new. Yeah. Sinn Féin are the oldest.
The coming party, the coming lot.
Yeah. But I mean,
it's like reform. Reform are more establishment in some ways, than the Greens. You know, they're connected. Nigel Farage said, "Oh, establishment." You've been a politician for how many years, mate? How much of the Queen's shilling have you been taking? You're established.
And the EU shilling.
EU shilling.
Well, EU shilling is our shillings as well. No, but we put
and
money.
And he's not getting a Queen's shilling this time, either.
And it would be the King as well. But no, but the money that goes into the EU comes from the country. So in a sense, you know, there's a to-in and fro-in where the money comes from. But the point is, he's on the payroll.
While we're on reform came second in nearly 100 seats,
wow.
98 seats. So they've made a massive difference. And, they've sort of, because of the system, lost the opportunity to get lots and lots of candidates, MPs.
Well, what they've done is trash the Tories.
That was the point I was going to make. I mean, that's exactly that, because the Tories had so many safe seats, so many huge majorities. I mean, one of the things that I noticed when we're getting the feed last night, listening to the scores on the doors, with people winning with 15,000 majorities, and I'm thinking, where's all the 20,000s? Well, you know, where are they? And I think the only one I heard that was 30,000 or had 30,000 votes was Rishi Sunak. Very few were getting, you know, it was Chingford, where the Labour vote was split 12,000 between Pfizer, Shaheen, and the Labour candidate. Those two 12,000 together would have been 24. Ian Duncan Smith won it on 15.
Yes, and of course the Labour Party got rid of Fahir Shazeen because of her pro-Palestinian views, even though she's been the candidate for years. She's born in the constituency.
Yep. Yeah, they had a clean in her house a couple of weeks before the...
In order to thwart the pro-Palestinian element within their own party, they're prepared to have Ian Duncan Smith, who imposed universal credit on us, back in power.
Isn't that weird? Weird,
but
right?
But it's not weird. It's appalling.
It's... Yeah,
I'm disgusted.
Well, the thing is, I'm watching my language after the first sentence that I made, so I'm going to stick with weird. But yes, there are other words that I would genuinely love.
You can imagine the Muslim community in that constituency are disgusted.
I know Chingford quite well, actually, and it's such a shame. That's all I'm going to say. It's such a shame. But actually, you know, as constituencies go, Chingford is quite an affluent constituency, which is why Ian Duncan Smith has somehow found a way to last. He also claims to be quite a good constituency MP, but he would see that, wouldn't he? So, yeah. The architect of universal credit. Oh, my gosh. Wow. I can't think of a good word to say about
that. Do you think Labour is going to be thinking about some sort of universal basic income, Martin? We were hearing about this from the Greens last week.
I think that debate is going to go on, but they're very much within the conventional parameters of what Labour government.
I can remember when we first had whatever it was, 3 million unemployed back in the 1980s. That there was everyone was shocked by that. Now we've got structural unemployment. We've got very low wages. We've got wages being even driven down by migrants, and there really is a serious problem about work is no longer a route out of poverty. So I wonder if either of you can address that one. Where are we going with this? You know, rents are going up. Wages are pretty much stable, particularly at the lower end.
I think the issue of a basic income probably is a term two kind of issue. Some seeds, you know, that as Martin said, that debate is going to continue because it's not going to go away. Things have changed. Technology is having an impact. The suppression of wages for the last 14 years or so, you know, all of these things means that they're going to have a new way of looking at it. I think actually, ultimately, it is inevitable that will be the case, that there will be a universal basic income. How far away it is, I don't know. It probably won't happen in the second term, but I think we'll start to have more, well, it will be bubbling away between now and then. People like us, think tanks, they'll be discussing it. You know, I can see the Resolution Foundation pushing out a couple of things, but it won't get too deep until maybe the second term where it might start to have a serious conversation. But then by that time, Labour probably would have used up its credibility, and it will get dropped before anything can seriously be done with it. So it's going to be, I'm thinking of maybe another generation. We need more in a sense. I feel like I'm about to talk Labour Party policy now. There needs to be growth in this economy and growth in people's lives. So the issues of in work poverty are removed. That's got to be the priority now, which will then decrease the need in people's eyes for looking at a universal
this
basic
idea
income.
Of in
'cause
it's work, easier to achieve. In-work poverty, Martin, really important issue, hardly discussed.
Yes, of course. I mean, we all know what's happened. People actually in work are often worse off than they were on benefits.
Even when both partners are working, you know, it's very often not enough money.
Can I just make a comment about migrants? Most of the increase in migrants recently, the legal increase, has been people coming and working in the health service because the wages are so low. The big strikes, of course.
That's exactly what we're saying. The wages are so low.
Yes, well, you can't increase the wages in the National Health Service or the care sector without government expenditure. Mm. It's not something that, and to do that, you've then got to find the money, which they're not going to do.
So keep saying that they can find the money if they want.
Well, they can, but they won't.
So are they going to? No, they're not.
This is one of the ones, this is revenue. This is not one of the ones that they're going to find. I think it is a growth-based argument. So if they say we're going to get a social care, if I was Keir Starmer, what I would do is say, okay, look, we're going to set up a royal commission to look at social health and social care and come up with a new way of doing it. It's going to be revitalizing, rebuilding, you know, NHS Mark II. That's what we're going to do. And that's going to take four years minimum.
That's kicking the can. down the road.
Of course. But that's what they do, right?
They they're just have to spend money. But Rachel Reeves is not going to do it.
They're not going to do that. So they can only kick the... That's my point. They can only kick the can down the road. However, there does need to be a Royal Commission, because you can't do this unless there is multilateral agreement for what comes out. Even with a large majority, Labour cannot push this through.
I think they could easily push it through with the big majority they've got if they actually came out with a decent idea. And there are plenty of ideas out there, but they all involve spending money. Money that they don't have at the moment.
Can I just say on all of this, this presumes that the conditions in the outside world remain the same as they are now, which they are not. Don't forget that the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by the Americans has wrecked the European economy, and we are part of that economy. And there's more of this to come, as I was mentioning earlier, the Red Sea. If the war in the Middle East escalates, there's quite likely going to be a financial crash. So you're not going to be dealing with what we're dealing with.
At the moment, the things look as if they may be ramping down a bit in Gaza.
Listen, the point is that as long as the Gaza thing goes on...
I don't know if you saw, this is really part two.
We're at war with...
I don't know if you've been following it, but there's a dispute in the New York Times a couple of days ago published this rather bombshell of an article saying that the IDF, the Israeli army, want to ceasefire.
Yes,
they want to stop, but Netanyahu won't.
No. All right. Well, we'll come to this in a minute. Obviously, this is a long show. Yeah. We do all this stuff later on.
So things might be calming down a bit there.
These things interact.
The lawn having been mown.
Yes, I know. The point I'm making about all of this is presuming that the external conditions remain stable, and they're not going to remain stable. Yeah? Nobody discussed the destruction of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline in this election.
There seems to be a coalition against Russia, doesn't there?
If we have a major war, NATO is already involved. I mean, when that Storm Shadow missile was fired into, you saw what's happened at Sebastopol last week. It looked like an American missile had been deliberately targeted at Russian holidaymakers. You can imagine that doesn't make the Russians happy. Yeah. At all. And they've been given warnings to the British in particular, because they're probably...
So what's the effect of this on the British?
If there is a big crash, we may find that more radical policies have to be brought. Yeah? Because you've got to. Mm. Yeah?
Yeah.
Like the pandemic.
So it could be good. If we have a war with Russia,
so that could be good. We go on a war, we have a war.
That could be good for Granny.
It just means they will wobble around all over the place, but it may well be in an emergency. They'll have to say, well, let's just spend some money. Because they can. The magic money tree clearly exists. Mm. We saw that during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And nobody cares, really. I mean, Kwasi Kwarteng smashed the economy because he just didn't cost out what he was doing. As long as you say what you're doing, and you can say, well, we're going to borrow the money and this, that, and the other. If you're going to spend it on stuff that
we're
people really
print
need,
more.
Yeah. And Rachel Reeves might be forced to do this in spite of herself, because they may be put under pressure to cut public expenditure. But they must resist that. And if we're going to resist that, you might as well say, well, let's spend some flipping money. Why don't we get on with it?
Before we have the second half of Starmer's speech, let's just also, I think, you know, I like to doff my cap to the Workers' Party and what they've attempted to do, which is a sort of old-fashioned Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn did get in again as an independent, and it would have been, I would have thought, more sensible for him to hook up with some of his former Labour colleagues like Galloway and Chris Williamson, but he decided not to do that. Anyway, they did issue a statement earlier on today, and because they get so little, if not zero, coverage around the country, particularly with these leadership debates, where I would love to have seen Starmer and Galloway going head to head in one of the leadership. I mean, for me, I'm looking at all these leadership debates thinking, oh, it's snooze fest. The only interesting thing for me during those debates was one occasion where somebody said that, is this really the best you can do, and got the biggest round of applause from the audience of the entire debate. And the other one was, you're like a robot. Another great round of applause from the audience.
Yeah, people being disrespectful.
But he does. I mean, he comes across as a sort of controlled person that he's not actually his own man.
Well, it's a bit circusy, isn't it? Oh, you're not Boris Johnson, are you? Where's your career?
But no one else. None of the.
And that's how you get Boris Johnson.
Just a minute. None of the journalists say this. the member of the public does. Oh, that's why they get around the applause.
It's funny, you know, I'm not really a fan of Vox Pops. I watch and the on the BBC, they're the your vote, your voice. Yeah. And they go around asking people stuff and people just shows you just how lack of attention to detail that people around the country have, how uninformed they are, and how people need to be educated. We need to fix our education system. This rudeness that is applauded by people. There's no reason for us to be.
But it's also like that. Satire. It's bursting the bubble. If someone does that, they get a round of applause. Oh. I don't think it's just rude. Look, listen, when you're doing Vox Pops, I've done loads of, in my time, God, in London particularly.
Oh my God.
You get good Vox Pops and bad Vox Pops, and you get all sorts of interesting. But when people are walking past your stew around, you're going, approaching them, saying, you know, as I used to do, I'm just a
roving journalist.
They think, initially they think that you're there to sell them something. When they realise, oh, we just want your opinion, then they tend to warm to you a bit. But you know, if I just talk to a random selection of people, I will get a load of rubbishy Vox Pops of people that don't really know much about what they're talking about and haven't actually got much to say. But if you have a bit of discernment about, oh, that person looked, ah, right, and you tend to get some much more astute comments. And this is what you tend to get, I think, also on things like Question Time. You get some silly comments, but you get some absolutely spot on as well. And these people, I would like to pluck them out and make them journalists, because the actual state of journalism generally, what with, for example, this woman, Fiona Bruce, the woman from Antiques Roadshow, taking over from Dimbleby, who why can't they? I was looking at a little bit of the coverage last night, and thinking to myself, let's bring him back, you know, because he knows everything. He's really knowledgeable. Well, he holds their feet to the fire. If they say anything, Fiona Bruce is all doughy-eyed and, oh, yeah, that sounds cool. But no, Dimbleby would say, well, that's just not true, is it? You know, blah, 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 blah. And he knows far more than they do.
Well, even Victoria Derbyshire's got a harder edge. I mean, I ended up watching Channel 4. I found Emily Maitlis much more astute than Laura Kunzberg. If I can put it like
that. Koonsberg and Chris Mace. I mean, the BBC.
Oh my God.
Days.
Oh my God.
Please.
Chris Mace, don't get me started.
They come out with all sorts. Anyway, the Workers' Party is where I started. And I'd just like to read out a little statement from them, because they get so little coverage. And I think they've all sorts of potential. They got it totally wrong. As we were saying earlier, they should have gone for maybe between 5 or 10 seats and concentrated all their effort there up north somewhere. And they didn't, but they failed. So anyway, thinking they were going to get a landslide. This is what often happens with politicians. They've got big heads. They think that they've got masses of support, where actually, no.
Gorgeous George. Yeah.
They need to talk to the strategic communication labs, the massive PR companies, strategic communication companies, who would tell them, listen, whoever pays us, we make sure they win. You know? And it doesn't matter. There'll be some scandal, like, for example, this Farage thing. That was interesting, wasn't it? Just the week before the election, there's suddenly somebody who's extremely racist as part of the Reform UK campaign. And then it turns out the guy's an actor. Well, at least that's what they say.
Oh, no.
And he was.
It's come out. Ofcom did an emergency check and dropped it.
Well, that was handy, wasn't it? They did that very quick.
All points. Because there was a general election, they felt the need to put a crack team on it.
Yes.
And they have looked at the case, and Channel 4 has no case to answer.
So we trust Ofcom.
I trust Ofcom more than I trust Farage. Yeah.
Well, I don't necessarily know. Ofcom has blocked the Russian TV from the UK. They've also blocked the Iranian TV. Isn't Ofcom just NATO?
No. I trust Ofcom more than I trust the Reform Party. I'm just saying, you know. I mean, and it's not even Ofcom. It's not Ofcom. It's civil servants.
Anyway, I will do. Well, they're not. I spoke to Ofcom years ago.
No, they are civil servants.
No, they're not. I spoke to them about the consumer panel of Ofcom, right? And they explained to me that the board that they appoint, they get recommended by Odgers. Odgers is a corporate headhunting team, so they're getting the same sort of people who would be non-executive directors.
I'm talking about the staff.
The non-executive directors So you used to work for Ofcom.
Yeah, the people there are civil.
They don't trust them at all.
They have a civil service.
They're very political.
They have a civil service mentality.
So but what I will do, though, is I will put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the decision so that you can go make your own minds up, folks, as to whether this was actually an actor. I mean,
I've met many people from the Reform Party, and the views expressed the guy that was recorded are views that are rife.
It was hardly great. Undercover journalists.
No, it really
wasn't. They're going to come out with spots,
especially when they've had a drink. So, you know
Channel 4 at Horse Ferry Road used to be just like literally back onto MI5.
A building is a building. They've got to be based somewhere. And that was then, and this is now. And that's not the thing. The thing is, and this is probably an independent production company anyway that has a deal. Look, it's very easy to smear a large broadcaster. It's also very easy to smear Farage, but because it was the vetting company that they gave 150K to didn't do their job, and we want our money back. Come on. Look, Nigel Farage, the wolf in sheep's clothing that is Nigel Farage. So one of his big announcements today was, all those people, we're going to go back and have another look, and they're out. We're turfing them all out.
They've done extremely well, actually. Amazingly well.
They've
destroyed the Tory party. Basically.
Well, they could have done that last time, and then we wouldn't have had Brexit.
Why they didn't do it, isn't it?
Exactly.
And anyway, people wanted Brexit, so they voted for it.
They don't want it now, Tony. If you look at the opinion polls, everybody's decided it's a pig in a poke.
Maybe everybody, eh? Yeah.
Well, the majority.
Yeah. So anyway, I don't necessarily... Most of them are dying, you know.
The majority in 2016, as you say, many of them are dead.
It for a few years. Anyone can remember things before the EU is dead. So let's have another vote, and these kids can decide.
Well, in actual fact, the whole purpose of politics is to change according to, people can change their minds.
Let's have a United States of Europe. Why not? They should just put that on the ballot paper.
No.
The United States of America has been very successful.
We're doing now is we're getting into a general conversation about all sorts of stuff. I understand Sakir is waiting in the wings to enlighten us about further.
He certainly is. But before that, we're going to hear a little statement from the Workers' Party. We can hold our heads high, they say. That we gained over 200,000 votes, and they did it extremely well. It's just they were scattergun. It was like a blunderbuss right across the north of England. They didn't say that. I did. Many, however, will be understandably disappointed that we will not have an MP in the next Parliament. Then again, with our fierce anti-imperialist socialist policies, the establishment put every obstacle in our way. From Rishi's address condemning our victory in Rochdale earlier this year, an almost total mainstream media blackout, to the violence against our activists on the streets, the ruling classes have used every dirty trick to undermine our party, our politics, and the British working class, and shutting them out of the leadership debates as well, as we were talking about earlier. Our party, says the Workers' Party, will not disappear quietly into the night. Workers continue to die from austerity. Palestinians are still undergoing genocide. And so all that's changed is the ruling class have brought a new management to do their dirty work. For the struggles ahead, workers now need more than ever their own political party. It is the only way we can organise ourselves, educate ourselves, and be united in action for workers. Our unity is our strength. Well, there's a little bit of the old sort of lefty rhetoric in there, Martin, but actually this is going to be, surely, at the next general election, an even bigger thorn in the side of Keir Starmer, isn't it? This party's not going away.
Well, I mean, I don't think they will go away, but 200,000 votes is good, but it's not like Reform, for example. They're not in that league, are they? You know, and or Sinn Féin. You know, they're not in that league. And, of course, the Labour...
I think you might... No, maybe not Sinn Féin.
These Labour MPs, if there is, for example, a vote to go to war with Lebanon, OK? That could easily come up quite quickly. Because if the Israelis go into Lebanon,
or the Lebanese attack Israel,
Hezbollah will fight, and they will win. And the only way that the Israelis can win is if the Americans go in behind them. And then Starmer will have to have a vote in Parliament: are we going to go to war with Lebanon to keep the Americans happy, to keep the Israelis happy? Now, how many of these Labour MPs will go along with that? Yeah. So many of these Labour MPs might have a sense of self-preservation and decide, no, we're not going to go along with that, which is why we didn't go to war with Syria after the fake chemical weapons attack years ago. Yeah. Now, we used to be an imperial power. We used to be the centre of a world empire.
The Labour Party is now an imperial party.
Well, it always was, Tony. Yeah. It's not as if it's a new thing. And of course, the politics of our old empire will impinge on us because we're drawn in. We're the only European country bombing Yemen alongside the Americans.
Is that all going to stop now?
No, it isn't going to stop now because the Houthis are winning because they know what they're doing. Well, they've been fighting for years against the Saudis who are backed by the British.
But if you build weapons, you build warplanes or you build warships and you're going to want to sell them so you can make money, they're going to be used. Britain and America are pretty good at building weapons of destruction and selling
Americans,
it to people.
The Americans are. Well, we're not building much anymore.
No, they've got a piece of the pie. Can I just go back to the Workers' Party? The Workers' Party. How many trade unions support the Workers' Party? Do we know? Are there any trade unions that support the Workers' Party? I'm guessing there's probably not because it's not the Workers' Party. It's George Galloway's party. You know, the latest incarnation, just like Reform is Nigel Farage's latest incarnation. I actually would like there to be a Workers' Party. It used to be the Labour Party was the party of workers. It's becoming that less and less because of politics, and it would be good to have a Workers' Party, but I don't think the Workers' Party is that party, at least not yet. It's George Galloway's thing, isn't it?
Well, they do have party conventions, and it is George Galloway's the leader, but I don't think he's the only game in town. He's also got Chris Williamson as a former Labour MP is standing in Derby. Didn't get in. But anyway, no. I did promise earlier, a long time ago, it seems eons ago, to look at what under proportional representation, what the vote would look like. So this is a YouGov poll taken last week. If the UK had a proportional representation voting system, what would be the outcome on Friday? Well, what they say is, if it had been PR, and maybe they could do an updated version with the actual vote, but they were just looking there at the polling at the time, which is pretty much accurate. Anyway, so they would say Labour 218 seats, so up 18, not hundreds. Conservatives 132, that's down 240, so big decrease for the Tories. Reform UK under a PR system. Do you want to guess, either of you, how many MPs
probably
they would have got?
About 130.
104. Oh. Yeah, not bad. The Greens, Martin?
They've got about 6% of the vote, haven't they? I can't guess.
78 MPs.
Yeah, I was going to say 70.
Lib Dems, 76 MPs, yeah. And the SNP would have been 19, down 29. So it's an enormous difference, isn't it?
Well, you say that, but let me just say this. If we had a proportional representation, there would be more right-wing parties like the Heritage Lot and English Heritage and all these other parties. So they would have eaten into the Reform thing. So there'd be lots more splinter groups or smaller groups that would, you know, we haven't talked about the parties that didn't make it into Parliament.
There
like
weren't
the
many people
like
standing.
Like the Women's Equality Party. Yeah,
Monster Raving Looney too.
Monster Raving Looney too and Count Binface and all of those.
But there are hardly any parties in this election standing against the Russia war. Hardly any. The Heritage Party and George Galloway, so I think we're the only two. Mm. So this is incredible, isn't it, really?
We haven't discussed the war with Russia during the election, because everybody thinks
everyone
they
agrees.
Know what they think
it's
about
deal,
it.
Isn't it?
Everyone agrees. We must stand fast with America and NATO.
But under PR, there would be more of these parties. There would be, because now you know that if you got a system to get yourself national, even if you only get 10 votes in Great Yarmouth, it's going to add to your national tally and may result in you getting a seat. And to be honest, I think generally not every view, but most views deserve a seat at the table, and some form of PR system needs to be created that allows that. I think the bigger parties would lose seats, but it would create a more diverse thing, which then takes us to one of your original questions with PR. How's it going to work? Well, people are going to have to talk to each other, aren't they?
Now, people might wonder why we're banging on about PR the whole time, and that's because this system really does not reflect public opinion, does it?
No, and it never can. First past the post never can. Brexit proved that. More people didn't vote than voted, and look at the result.
Yeah, well, that's because people felt that they were actually turning out to vote for something worthwhile, because most of the other previous elections have been the, you know, the Uniparty, one of the either Team A or Team B. Let's have something that's actually going to make a difference rather than this drift towards being ruled by Brussels. Let's actually run our own affairs. And of course, Otto von Habsburg, he commented at the time, he said it's very entertaining watching the British try to leave.
Yeah,
because they won't be able to. Doesn't matter what they vote.
No, because we are based in. Look, we live in Europe. I mean, what the hell? You can't legislate against geography.
No, look, hang on. It's not. It's not legislating against geography, though, is it? Because all these nations have not been given a choice. Do you want to give up being a nation and join a superstate?
The nature of this planet.
That's just been told.
No, well, yeah, but the reason I say
I
say
the same
like
in
that,
Africa. No, tell the Africans.
You trade with your. You trade. You do most of your trade geographically with your nearest neighbours.
Yes, I do. Africa.
You just do.
So we're going to have one big country running Africa.
There isn't. Africa is 58.
That's called
countries.
The Organisation of African Unity's position, Tony. One big country, Africa. Kwame Nkrumah. Yeah. And of course, Pan-Africanism, the Pan-African Congress, were
the main
left opposition
to
the African National Congress.
So he had to be killed.
Yeah, to be taken out. It's one of the reasons why he got taken out, it's believed. Yeah. It's because he was a Pan-Africanist.
That's right.
Do we have the same in South America too?
Yes, it's Bolivarian, the Bolivarian bloc.
Yeah,
as you can see,
who are ridiculed and denigrated by the West.
So, who does centralisation of power favour then? If it's done without the consent of the people?
Well, I mean, listen, big countries can succeed. Look at the United States of America. Russia is a massive country with huge resources and a very, very well-educated population. And they've now got a political system which looks pretty good to me. They know exactly, it actually works. The people who vote, Putin is definitely in charge, unlike Biden.
Oh, yes,
their army is winning a war that the people support. And they've not, people aren't vote. The main pressure on Putin is to finish the war quickly, but he's a quite crafty person. He's not necessarily going to go all out. They're much more sophisticated. The level of their leadership is fantastic. Putin, Lavrov, Gerasimov, who's the
They call Lavrov the world's greatest chess player.
And Gerasimov, who's the field marshal, makes the American military look
is
like
there
a bunch
any
of
hope
goons.
Of us having leaders that we love as much as actually the Russians love their leaders?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn had a lot of that kind of stuff coming towards him. But anyway, we ought to really sort of move into more detail. You know, this is becoming a very wide-ranging discussion. Now, we've got no more...
Well, you can just walk away or something.
No, all right, I'm happy to chat. It's just that they've got hours to go, you know.
Well, we've got lots to talk about here, actually. We've got quite a bit to say. But I think you're hinting you want me to... play the second half of this.
I want to hear my hero,
Sakir. We want to hear from Sakir.
Sakir, the guy who over to Sweden especially to try and get Julian Assange prosecuted when he was Director of Public Prosecutions. Also, under his watch, two prosecutions of Jimmy Savile that didn't get through from Surrey Police. He wasn't actually involved, but he was the boss of the... He was the Director of Public Prosecutions, the Director of the Crown Prosecution Service at the time. The guy in charge of all of that was a mate of, in fact, in charge today, making Keir Starmer Prime Minister, is the King, Prince Charles, who was very friendly with Jimmy Savile. So maybe there is a connection here, maybe not. But anyway, let's have a listen now to our new King giving the second half of his speech outside Downing Street earlier on today.
Yet, if I'm honest, service is merely a precondition of hope. And it is surely clear to everyone that our country needs a bigger reset, a rediscovery of who we are, because no matter how fierce the storms of history, one of the great strengths of this nation has always been our ability to navigate a way to calmer waters. And yet this depends upon politicians, particularly those who stand for stability and moderation, as I do, recognizing when we must change course. For too long now, we've turned a blind eye as millions slid into greater insecurity. Nurses, builders, drivers, carers, people doing the right thing, working harder every day, recognised at moments like this before, yet as soon as the cameras stop rolling, their lives are ignored. I want to say very clearly to those people, not this time. Changing a country is not like flicking a switch. The world is now a more volatile place. This will take a while. But have no doubt that the work of change begins immediately. Have no doubt that we will rebuild Britain with wealth created in every community. Our NHS back on its feet facing the future. Secure borders, safer streets, everyone treated with dignity and respect at work. The opportunity of clean British power, cutting your energy bills for good. And brick by brick, we will rebuild the infrastructure of opportunity. The world-class schools and colleges, the affordable homes that I know are the ingredients of hope for working people. The security that working-class families like mine can build their lives around. Because if I asked you now whether you believe that Britain will be better for your children, I know too many of you would say no. And so my government will fight every day until you believe again. From now on, you have a government unburdened by doctrine, guided only by the determination to serve your interest, to defy, quietly, those who have written our country off. You have given us a clear mandate, and we will use it to deliver change, to restore service and respect to politics. End the era of noisy performance, tread more lightly on your lives, and unite our country. Four nations standing together again, facing down, as we have so often in our past, the challenges of an insecure world, committed to a calm and patient rebuilding. So, with respect and humility, I invite you all to join this government of service in the mission of national renewal. Our work is urgent, and we begin it today. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm not sure if that's all the mainstream press cheering. No, I think it's actually a bunch of Star Wars supporters bust into Downing Street.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Literally, that, yes.
It was. So there he is talking about unity. I mean, all the right things, but to be honest, I shouldn't say to be honest. It's a very lacklustre speech. It doesn't enthuse me. He's coming out with sort of hackneyed platitudes about unity, not very much to it. But Martin, did you hear anything there that sort of fires you up?
Well, no. I mean, in any case, what sort of a speech do you expect him to make on an occasion like this? He's just going to come out with what you might expect him to say.
I expect there to be a bit of personality in it, a bit of character.
No, look, listen.
A bit of humour. No humour. No humour.
The thing about Starmer.
No wit. If it was Boris Johnson, you always get a bit of humour, a bit of wit in there.
And that's exactly what people voted against. They don't want Starmer.
No, it isn't. No, they don't want Johnson. They want a bit of wit and humour.
No, they don't.
They do. That's why he got called a robot.
Yes, and if a robot can actually fix the roads, then that's what we need, isn't it? Okay. I think that's why
one day a robot will be fixing roads. Look, it's weird. In a sense, you're both kind of right, and that's part of the problem. People want a show. You know, they're a circus. Boris is a ringmaster. Trump, he's a ringmaster. People want circuses. They want a show. They have been conditioned into getting a show. But what we need as a country is what you're talking about, Martin. I don't want to be entertained by my politicians, but then that's me. But there are people
I want my leaders to have some character, but then there are people
that want them to have character, personality, and a bit of humour. And apparently, Keir Starmer is a very humorous man. He likes a laugh and a joke. He likes a game of five-a-side and blah, 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 and a bit of banter, But he's decided you're not getting that. You're getting the serious guy. And at the moment, we require a bit of serious. I hope, you know, and I heard them talking about it on the news. He seems to have grown a couple of inches. He has seemed to relax. His constituency speech was far more effective and shorter and less boring and less monotone than the speech. But look, this is the first time the guy's had the lectern outside number 10. I'm not expecting bells and whistles
it's
yet.
Not the first time he's done a political speech, if he's setting the tone for the next five years it's just more boring.
He's not ready.
He's going to switch people even more ready. Off politics.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Right, and please bear this in mind. He is a relatively inexperienced politician, just as Rishi Sunak was, and we saw the limits of Rishi Sunak's experience, i.e. the D-Day thing, the lack of nous. Keir Starmer's gone down a slightly different road, and he's got to the top job, and he's still a relatively inexperienced thing. I draw strength, for what it's worth, from the fact, and it's going to, you know, that he's got a few experienced people.
Well, he's a lawyer, isn't he?
And lawyers, he's got Rishi Sunak, not Rishi Sunak, Sadiq Khan on speed dial.
We'll see
what happens.
Yeah,
next.
Well, maybe which of them's in charge?
The way I don't know if you saw Sadiq Khan talking. On the night of the election night in the thing, it was pretty much like, well, we're mates. We were lawyers together. We're really good mates. Like, has he got you on speed dial? And the answer is probably yes.
And of course, Sadiq Khan came out straight away. We've got to have a ceasefire in Gaza.
Mm. Well, so Keir Starmer wasn't quite the same. Let's go back to October last year and have a listen to Starmer being asked about whether he thought it was okay under international law to take people's food and water away.
Do you think it's acting within international law?
I think it's unwise for politicians to stand on stages like this or to sit in television studios and pronounce day by day which acts may or may not be in accordance with international law. I think it's not the role of politicians.
Is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
Yes.
Yes.
What I've seen already amounts to war crimes, particularly the awful attacks on civilians. And I think it's very important that he's held to account and is responsible. And all those that are acting with him know that they too will be held to account. This is something which we need to make clear now, so that those who are involved at the moment know what the consequences are.
So that's Keir Starmer not talking about Gaza there, but talking about Russia. And I thought it was quite hilarious the way he says, oh, no, we're going to have no discussion. I think it's very unwise to talk about whether war crimes are taking place. And then, except with Putin, of course, he's a war criminal, isn't he? So this is he's part of the drive for war, isn't he, Martin?
He is. He's very much in. He's been over to the American. I mean, this is what Blair did. He went over to say to the Americans, what do you want us to do? That's and of course, that's what did for Tony Blair in the end, ultimately.
They literally drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, that's
to be
right.
Honest. They went over there, drank the Kool-Aid, and they were all in.
Yeah.
There seems to be, I'm going to use this phrase, an establishment thing where it's, you know, as Blair put it in the note, we're with you, whatever. As far as America's concerned, we are the lapdog, the puppy, the yap, yap, yapping around. Yeah, what do you want, boss? Send me. What do you want me to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, in relation to Russia, we've been so keen to get things, you know, to get things started, like the assassination of Zakarchenko, who's was the prime minister of the Donetsk Republic, was killed by a bomb in a light fitting. British special forces were probably involved in that. Yeah. And of course, they're jumping ahead of the game. The British were the first to say, we're going to allow our missiles to be fired into Russia. Mm. And then the Russians called in the British ambassador and said, if you do that, we might fire missiles into Britain. Have you thought about that? And the Americans were saying, calm down, calm down, bulldog. You know, so that we're even ahead of the game of the Americans. The Americans have a bit of some cold feet, you know, and we're actually trying to encourage even
we're like the sniffer dog, lap dog kind.
But
of
I mean, this is Starmer, isn't it?
PL
I mean,
bullies.
He's asked about what he's supposed to be an international human rights lawyer. He's asked about Gaza. his immediate reaction is, yes, it's okay to starve people and stop their water supplies. So yeah. This is one of the reasons it may be that people like Thangam Debonair were removed
at
this election, is because there is, he just can't stop himself. There was also that whole business of the ceasefire vote, where the Labour Party sabotaged the vote, so it didn't actually happen properly. Mm. So it's almost like he is secretly, quietly in bed with the Israel lobby.
No, I don't think it's that. But what it is he's a politician. You mentioned, I know you're a fan,
any
Martin.
Politician.
He's a typical politician trying to do whatever it takes to get power and stay in power. And you know, you don't like these principles? I have some more that I can show you. Look, you described him as an international, what was it, an international lawyer?
International human rights lawyer, yeah.
Yeah. He's not.
He was. That's how he became DPP.
He was.
And that's how he became leader of Labour.
And then he was leader of a political party, and now he's prime minister.
Has he totally sold his soul?
He takes the hat off and puts the new hat on, and now I'm in that role. Yes.
It's like every different role, your soul is deeply stripped from you.
Yes, in order to get up the greasy pole, that's what you have to do.
Oh,
and that's what
sad.
He's done.
Yeah, interesting. Very sad, though.
It is very sad.
Martin, is there any hope, do you think, for the people of Gaza with Starmer around? Is there a light at the end of the tunnel?
Well,
now, he's made it to this job. It might be that he starts to find himself a conscience.
Well, I think, let's just leave the Russian thing aside, because that's quite clear. The Overton window in this country is we want a war with Russia. Absolutely insane from my point of view, but there we are. On Gaza, the real problem is that the Israelis will not have a ceasefire. And they're probably going to go into the Lebanon.
Okay, let's have a listen to him now.
This will cause a major war.
Just discovered the clip. Here we go.
I'm very clear. Israel must have that, does have that right to defend herself. And Hamas bears responsibility.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power? Cutting off water?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation. Obviously, everything should be done within international law, but I don't want to step away from the sort of core principles that Israel has a right to defend herself and Hamas bears responsibility.
I know that LBC clip has been widely shared and caused real concern and distress in some Muslim communities. So let me be clear about what I was saying and what I wasn't saying. I was saying Israel had the right to self-defence, and when I said that right, it was that right to self-defence. I was not saying that Israel had the right to cut off water, food, fuel or medicines.
A siege is appropriate? Cutting off power? Cutting off water? Sakir?
Well, I think that Israel does have that right. It is an ongoing situation. Obviously, everything should be done within international law, but I don't want to step away from the sort of core principles that Israel has a right to defend herself and Hamas bears responsibility.
Yeah, so there you've got a bit of both sides. He's trying to defend himself, then you can hear him again. You're right, in a way, that he's done this because he knows that he needs to do this. Isn't it the same in the States, Martin, actually? If you want to reach high political office, you've got to be pro-Israeli. You've got to be part of the lobby.
Absolutely. They're even going to pass a law through Congress now, the suppressing anti-Semitism law, which will criminalise pro-Palestinian speech. That's where we're at.
Yeah, I think they would think about that over here as well, wouldn't they? Yeah. That was on the cards.
Yeah, not anymore, surely. Now, after what we've seen, nearly 40,000 civilians, you know, massacred. Yeah.
Well,
and it's not really. I mean, they keep talking about it as a war. It doesn't really. It's not a war.
It's not a war.
If you're bombing people from the air,
it's not a war. It is literally a massacre.
Apart from the Hamas fighters who are still embedded in the tunnels.
Carry on, Don. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say. I mean, look, the Hamas did a thing as a result of the things that have been done to them. But what's happening is not... Look, you've got some guys with some guns, right, and a couple of anti-tank missiles. They have no... You know, one of the things that really gets me is they say, well, they're hiding among the civilian population. What do you expect them to do? Where do you expect them to go?
Where can they go?
You know, set up
else?
A military base so you can bomb it from above. Are you crazy?
From a military point of view, they're in those tunnels, dug in, They come out when they're ready and blow tanks up. Their families are being killed upstairs, but the Israelis don't dare to go
in
downstairs
those tunnels
to find them.
They've got nowhere else to go. They could not possibly have bases. They're in Lebanon. They're in Syria. They're in Iran. They're not sitting in a building, because when they are in a building in Lebanon and Syria and Iran, you bomb them in embassy anyway.
Well, that's right. But of course, Hezbollah have had a long time to prepare their defences in southern Lebanon.
Yeah.
Just as the Ukrainian army had a long time to prepare its defences before the phase of the war broke out.
If there is a war, it is the Israeli government versus some of the Arab countries around them. There is no war between Israel and the Palestinians. What there is a massacre.
Yeah, they're massacring
Palestinians, and occasionally killing some Hamas people at the same time.
Yes, that's right. But the massacre of the civilians makes no difference to the military balance.
Yes.
It's pointless.
And neither will lead to the end of the war.
I think we're going to see an increase in spending on the military under Starmer. That
Absolutely.
Seems to be the way. Let's have
way.
A listen to him, because he was interviewed during the election campaign about his intentions to do with spending on defence.
The truth is that after 14 years of the Tories, we are less safe and less secure. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. The Tories' own former defence secretary says the government has failed to take defence seriously. We have the smallest army since the time of Napoleon, at a time when other countries are firmly on a war footing. And so, even as we work tirelessly for peace, we have to be fit to fight. So let me be unequivocal. This Labour Party is totally committed to the security of our nation, to our armed forces, and importantly, to our nuclear deterrent. Just a few weeks ago, I visited BAE Systems in Barrow-in-Furness. I was the first Labour leader to visit in 30 years. I saw the nuclear submarines being made. I saw an industry that supports the local community. And I met workers who were proud to be doing their bit for our national security. They deserve our full support, and they will get it. The nuclear deterrent is the foundation of any plan to keep Britain safe. It is essential. That is why Labour has announced a new triple lock commitment to our nuclear deterrent. We'll maintain Britain's continuous at-sea deterrent 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, deliver all the needed upgrades, and we will build 4 new nuclear submarines, like the ones I saw in Barrow, that won't just keep us safe, but will also support good jobs and growth across the UK. One of my first visits after I became leader of the Labour Party was to Plymouth, the front line of defence in this country. Devonport alone employs 2,500 service people and civilians. It supports 400 local businesses and generates about 10% of Plymouth's income. And when I was there, I met the shipbuilding apprentices, talented, ambitious young people. And I looked them in the eye, and I promised that I would fight for the future of Plymouth's defence industry. And I will, because it's only by harnessing and supporting the strength of proud communities like Plymouth, Barrow, Aldershot, and so many more that means we can safeguard our security and our growth for decades to come. I mean, look at Ukraine now. Industrial capacity is an absolutely critical part of security. So with Labour, Britain will be fit to fight. Within the first year of a Labour government, we will carry out a new strategic defence review. We are absolutely committed to spending 2.5% of GDP on defence as soon as possible, because we know our security isn't just vital for our safety today, it's absolutely central to our success for the future. National security and economic security must go hand in hand.
So that's actually from a few weeks ago, but it gives you an idea of the stall that Starmer has set himself out on. He very much is putting himself forward, Martin, as we're getting ready for a battle with the Russians. We've got to spend much more on defence. You know, our army's become too small. This is traditional territory of the Tories, isn't it?
Yes, and of course he's two reasons he's gone onto that territory. One is to win over floating Tory voters. The other is because that's what the Americans have told him to do, and he's in their pocket.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Really. Yeah. What do you reckon?
I think it's more basic than that. He wanted to get elected, and he said what he needed to say to get elected. There's this thing they have. What's it? The Ming Vase thing. And what they did, and they spent most of their time doing, is taking the Tory weapons against them off the table. One by one, you know, it started. I mean, and before they got to having nuclear submarines and tanks and whatever, they started using the Union Jack in meetings.
But didn't the Tories just hand over these things to the Labour Party? Surely they just handed them. They've given up. I mean, all this stuff. For example, the whole business of social care, the stopping the boats, all these so-called flagship policies, they just gave up on them, and so they handed them to Labour.
Well, that's because the Conservative Party, and again, why we are where we are incompetent and not capable. The current Conservative incarnation of the Conservative Party, since Boris Johnson, actually probably since David Cameron, incapable of dealing with this. Theresa May tried to. It was called the death tax. So then we get to where we are, and so they've given up on them, and it's an open field. But what Labour need to do is take away the weapon needed to do. What Keir Starmer needed to do was take away the Tory normal modes of attack.
I think one is
patriotism, the other one is defence and safety, and he's taken those off the table. They had no weapons.
I was reading the other day something like half of Bristol's population smokes cannabis. Mm. Is it that much? Is it really that much? Anyway.
I used to run an entertainment agency many years ago, but I mean, I did that and I did lots of other stuff. There was a point in my life where when we were in operation, I never met anybody that never smoked. Everybody that I came, and even those that come along, I'm talking about weed. Yeah. They'd come along and people would be in their suits, people, you know, council officials or, you know, people but at an event. At an event that we put on, and they're backstage, and what's that? It was a big thing, wasn't it? And when they asked all the politicians, how many of you smoke weed at uni? And pretty much all of them did.
Yeah.
You know, and except and for was it goes, Cameron?
Oh gosh,
was
isn't
it Cameron?
Terrible?
But I didn't inhale.
No, Cameron.
Who was it that didn't inhale?
That was Bill Clinton.
Was it Bill Clinton?
Cameron nearly got thrown out of Eton for smoking weed.
Well, yeah, you know. Well, Cameron did lots of stuff that should have.
But then there's Coke, which is a different thing entirely. But just on.
The king of coke is Michael Gove. All the track marks of coke that they found in Westminster House
that's
of
right,
Commons
yeah.
toilets.
That's true.
You know, it's like what's that club they all go to?
Groucho.
No, not that. No. The one that was the one that is by Trafalgar Square. But the guy's passed away now. It was let's call it Annabelle's. Whether you use Annabelle's or no, it was the guy with the mullet. I can't even remember his name. He's passed away now.
You mean Peter Stringfellow?
Stringfellows. Stringfellows. Yeah. Their toilet had more coke lines than Stringfellows. That would have been funny if I'd got it right.
Okay, anyway, so what does Farage and the Reform, this resurgent new party that seems to be sort of eating into the Tory vote, and you might even find that they are part of the same kind of party at the next general election. What does Nigel Farage think about legalisation of drugs?
Paul Colesall, Resistance GB. About 10 years ago, you talked about having a royal commission into marijuana, maybe some other recreational drugs. Mm. Is that something that you think that we should look into?
Well, we're now in a better position because so many other countries have changed the law, they've liberalised, and now they've hardened again in some of the American states. We've now got a load of evidence we can actually look at. I haven't made my mind up fully on it yet, but it's interesting that in Oregon, where they went very soft on all drugs, they're now hardening the law again. So I'm still undecided, but I'm open-minded.
And you push for maybe a royal commission or some sort of investigation?
Well, I think the first thing you do is you have a look at Portugal, you have a look at Switzerland, you have a look at the American states, you have a look at Germany, of course, have just started an experiment as well. So we've actually got a chance. When I talked to you 10 years ago about it, it was a bit theoretical. Now we've got some hard evidence to look at to see, does it lead to less crime? Does it mean a lot more people take stuff that's bad for them? I think we've got a chance to really learn some stuff.
Thank you. Right, thank you, Mr. Blanchard.
Okay, so he's being supposedly open-minded. But what are both of your views about this one? Because for Bristol, it's a big issue. We've got the police increasingly running these drug workshops where people can bring drugs in to the police to see if they've been adulterated. And this seems to be obviously pretty sensible. The other thing is just general prohibition, as we know from the 1920s in the United States. It's a massive boondoggle for organised crime. But anyway, so what about you first, Martin, then you, Don? What's your thoughts on this? Are we moving forward?
Martin and Don can't both be first. Which one's first?
You.
Oh, me.
You weren't listening.
Right, well, I mean, you know my views. I've been very forthright.
Well, we won't ask you, Don. What's your view?
No, I don't know his views.
Very, very... The drugs industry was created originally by the CIA to try and win the war against the communist Chinese in China. So there was blockages at the end of the Second World War.
Didn't the British use it against?
Yes,
China?
The British. In obviously, this is the history of the British Empire. Of course, it is. But at the end of the Second World War, there was quite a large. It was a Democratic Congress in the US, and a lot of them were not really prepared to spend money to get involved in a civil war in China. They just thought we've got better things to spend our money on. So the CIA were frustrated by that and thought, what can we do to fund the nationalist Chinese who were losing the war against the communists? And then a light bulb went on in their heads, bing, we can just okay them to deal heroin. And they did. And the relationship between the CIA and the drug cartels is intimate. I went to Colombia on a trade union delegation in 2005, and the dogs in the street know all about this. Pablo Escobar's son said, everybody knows my father works with the CIA. And, of course, what they do is by keeping it illegal, they can. And if you are the state, you can decide who's going to be able to do stuff. You know, Air America was shipping during the Vietnam War. There's a lot of history in this, yeah? And, of course, they want to keep it illegal.
Yes or no?
I'm in favour of legalisation and regulation of all drugs, but a first useful step is what we've seen in Portugal, where they've legalized possession of all drugs for personal use. So that doesn't take the cartels out of the equation, but it takes the pressure off. People don't feel they're going to, you know, if they're being beaten up by their boyfriend, they don't say, oh we've got some drugs.
Yes, keep
Don
a go. What do you make?
Criminalization, using, let's say, cannabis. Let's talk about cannabis. To criminalise people, I think, is wrong. Sitting in the Kumba Centre, which is, you know, a Rastafarian-minded place, I'm not too far away from people seeing the herb as a sacrament. It's something that's natural and can grow naturally. Cannabis can grow naturally and is a natural plant that is in our society. Most of the things that are on this planet are here for a reason. That's there for a reason. However, coca grows naturally, but what they do with it, it's like ultra processed food, and they turn it into cocaine, or they turn things into opium, or they turn things into heroin or ketamine. These are ultra processed drugs. These are man-made drugs. Natural things are different. I would be very happy to see a regime of non-criminalization, and of allowing people to grow and market and smoke natural substances.
Doesn't marijuana cause schizophrenia?
It's all about the dosage, isn't it? And there's got to be regulation. I mean, tobacco, I mean...
Well, you can't regulate. If you're going to say, I'm going to decriminalise it, people are just going to binge, aren't they? They do with alcohol.
But tobacco's decriminalised, right?
Booze kills far more people than, you know, that's the point.
There's the point, isn't it?
You know,
really?
Alcohol is regulated. There can be regulation. I said decriminalised, not deregularised.
One of the things in regulation, when the Social Democrats came to power in Sweden in the 1930s, there was a real booze problem. There's people getting up and getting drunk on their version of vodka at 10 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. So when they came to power, they didn't ban it, like was in the United States. They nationalised it. You could only buy alcohol from state-run shops. And they were only open in certain hours of the day. And so, for example, you couldn't get any at 10 o'clock in the morning. But they didn't ban it. And I think that's I don't believe in free markets in anything. So what we should have is nationalised. I mean, heroin addicts used to be just given a supporting dose once they were recognised as addicts by the state.
One of the most interesting things is I know a couple of people that are heroin addicts. The thing is, you would never know they're heroin addicts because they're rich. Poor heroin addicts are a problem.
Because they have to steal.
They have to steal to supply their thing. But if you're rich and you can get the dosage right, you can sail through.
Think about Keith Richards.
Yeah, and there are many people. You know, again, cocaine, a processed drug, is used at the highest echelons of our society, seemingly without overdue, apart from Michael Gove, the odd little thing going on in his head. Look, natural substances, things that are here naturally, maybe they need to have some regulation and some control like other natural substances, but you know it's a tool used to criminalize people.
One thing we haven't mentioned is who's going to lead this new Tory party. Any thoughts about who might because obviously
that's a can of worms, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
I think ultimately, you see, when Farage made his speeches, you know, about Ukraine the other week, Suella Braverman, Priti Patel and Kemi Badenoch are all rabid anti-Putinists. So Farage, who fancies his chances in taking over the Tory party, isn't. And there's a split developing on the right in America between people who want to carry on fighting against Russia and those who definitely do not. And I think the right wing in this country will split over exactly that issue.
I'm kind of with you on that. I don't think whoever wins takes over the next one probably will not be prime minister.
Absolutely.
They're going to have to go backwards before they go forward. I think if they get someone of the left, as it were, one of the wets, as they used to call them, then the right, you know, the other four families are going to lose their stuff.
It won't be William Rees-Mogg.
He's gone.
He's gone. It won't be Liz Truss. She's gone. She's gone.
It amazed me last week when our guest, and we asked him who's going to win in your constituency, he said, well, it's obviously the Labour Party. Yeah. And, of course, that's because he's standing against Farage.
Just realistic. No, he was standing against Rees-Mogg.
It was great against Rees-Mogg.
But the point is that even without reform, Rees-Mogg actually was in all sorts of trouble there because the constituency boundaries have changed to take in more of Barr.
That's true. Yes. That's true.
But the point is, what about Priti Patel? They're talking about as a possible, maybe Suella Braverman as a possible.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of these people are another version of what we already had, and if they can, that's what will happen because the Tory membership will decide, and they are frankly nuts.
You say that, however, a lot of those nuts people, what did the swivel-eyed loons? That's what David Cameron called them. Yeah. The swivel-eyed loons. A lot of them have gone to reform.
That's right.
But you've got the ones that are left. I've only ever voted Tory. I'm still voting Tory. I don't care. I don't like what they've done, but I don't like that lot.
Yeah.
You know. But the swivel eye loons have said, a lot of them were the red wall people as well. They've gone. We're going to the right.
Yeah. And what will happen? It seems fairly clear to me. Reform are on a roll. The Tories are in collapse. The reform will take over the Tory party.
Except that it will be a diminished Tory party and will never reach that. Reform will never reach the heights.
No, because of course what they've peeled off is the moderate Tories. Yes. So a substantial chunk of the electorate.
We've been waffling away. I mean, I have too, to be fair, about all sorts of irrelevancies. Really, the only thing that matters is that the new leader of this country is more loyal to Davos and the World Economic Forum than he is to Westminster. He's said that openly. And also the other thing is his trilateral commission. Someone who's been,
he's been groomed.
Groomed by the Rockefeller Foundation in the trilateral commission, over a decade or so. But this surely is much more important for a leader to be favoured, surely, Don, by these mega corporations and these clubs where the super rich get together than it is by voters.
Well, I'd rather they were fated by the mega rich corporations than the Tufton Street Brigade, because the Tufton Street Brigade is led to Liz Truss. Who ignored even the corporates, the big corporates, and just thought, well, we're going to just... and blew up
Just let the World Economic Forum run the world? That would surely be a lot easier than having all these... Martin?
They don't run Russia and they don't run China, and no, that's the problem,
don't,
isn't it?
No.
Okay. Oh, so a couple have slipped through the net then.
But, well, maybe for now. Can you answer the question about the Trilateral Commission and World Economic Forum, Martin? They are the biggest sponsors of someone like Starmer. They were also very active against Corbyn, weren't they?
They were. So, in other words, the real power structure, there's the elections, and then there's the real power structure. I mean, don't forget that Tony Blair said Rupert Murdoch was the fourth most important, you know, he was the fourth member of the cabinet. And of course, Starmer will be similarly beholden to Rupe, yeah? If Rupe's still up for pulling the strings. And of course, there's a plan by the Western deep state to take down the Chinese economy, get the Russians back in the box, blah de blah. Then it's a hopeless plan, but Starmer will go along with it.
So
he's got no sense about it, foreign affairs, I mean, at all, apart from clinging to the flag.
Let's just have a little look at some of this new cabinet that's been announced today. I mean, it's a very depressing bunch looking at them. I don't really get inspired by any of these people, like Rachel Reeves, Angela Rayner, Keir Starmer. I mean, maybe it's a bit much for me to say I want them to be witty, David Lammy. I'd just like them to say something which, as it comes out of their mouth, it looks as if it's what they really think rather than what they think they ought to think. Yvette Cooper as Home Secretary, Pat McFadden, John Healey, Wes Streeting in Health, Bridget Phillipson, Ed Miliband is back. Now, this is almost like, so there's a balance going on here, isn't it? The Tories brought back Cameron, and so
Miliband
Labour
is an
brought back
MP. He's been part of
failure.
It's the right wing of the Labour Party back.
So people like, this is my take on this. People like Cameron and Miliband, once they'd failed and been booted out by the population at a general election as leaders, they used to get a nice job at the European Commission. Mm. Oh dear, we've had Brexit now, so they're no longer going to get that nice job at the European Commission. So we have to recycle them through the system and make them a minister, even though they were a prime minister and they failed.
Well, in fairness to Ed Miliband, he's still an MP.
Well, I'm not saying
unlike the guy who had his trotters up in his
well,
in his
Cameron shed. Could probably be if he wanted to stay as an MP.
Well, his constituency went to Labour, didn't it? Whitney was
it might
Labour?
Have done. Yeah,
yeah, it went Labour.
Might,
I thought it was Labour. It might have been Liberal.
That's
Democrat.
Only because Great Dave wasn't standing there anymore. Oh. You know? But anyway, I don't like this idea of recycling failed politicians. The whole point of electing people is you want to get. I mean, an election, I find, we were saying this in the archway while we were waiting to get in here earlier on today, is I find most of my voting is to get rid of someone I don't want. In fact,
that's first past the post for you, Tony.
That has actually happened here in Bristol, hasn't it, with the Greens and
I was just
going to
say,
I think across the country as well.
One of the people who was not on your list who wanted to be Culture Secretary is Thangam Debonair.
Oh, right, she's not
she
going
to
be
one now, is she?
Yeah, but I bet you'll probably get somebody even worse. That's what happens in politics.
Well, we had someone worse. Her name was Nadine Dorries.
Was she really?
She was the Culture Secretary.
Yes, I can.
Just cast your mind back.
It's like Dame Edra.
Martin and I actually went up for a little private meeting with Nadine Dorries. And she was human. Amazingly.
She is quite human and quite nice. Yeah.
She did a very good book as well about the coup to get rid of Boris Johnson.
If you go online...
she did. It's a good book.
If you go to YouTube and do a little search about Nadine Dorries and Reginald D. Hunter, the stand-up comedian. Reginald D. Hunt is a mate of mine, and he told me the story before I actually saw it, and it comes up where he was trying to chat Nadine up and she tried to palm her daughter off onto him and then said she's going to go and get a shotgun. But is actually completely set it up. But
I thought you didn't go for this sort of humour.
I used to do stand-up comedy. So, I mean, but it's not a humour. This is something that actually happened. It's a true story.
Okay, before we have our final item before the break, which will be about possible hidden agendas, I want to know what both of you think might be, down the trouser leg of Keir Starmer when he finally arrives at 1 of 10, when he's got his cabinet, right, we're going to do this and this and this, the things they didn't tell us, because it seems to be quite a lot of that going on. We'll have our weekly poem from Patrizio Opulenza this week. It's called Blood Red Dead, Death Blue Hue. The begging bowl is out this week. Help us win, they beg, they bleat. Give us cash to keep us going as the death toll mounts in Gaza growing. And genocide, each MP knowing. A seat may lose. Oh, what a shame. Too weak to vote, so they abstain. Blood on hands, the colour red. Labour is as guilty for the dead as cons, true blue, devoid of pride. WMDs on Israel's side. Red and blue makes the colour brown. In mud and dirt, see Gaza drown. The blues and reds, a demon team. For votes, not life, we hear them scream. While souls now lost and people run from east to west at point of gun. Bombs and dust hear howls and cries as the reds and blues fight for a prize. From post to pillar, from tent to trouble, to limbs and blood left in the rubble. Hands stained in blood, no good ear come. As to genocide, each soul succumbs. Of hate, not fate, where demons will round up families to maim and kill. Racist hatred runs deep in veins. Israel mad dog now off the reins. Voices muted from MPs we see. Each traitor to humanity. Well, let's hope a few have the guts to stand up and say what they really think about the genocide going on, and also the potential of a massive war in Europe for the Americans, as the Americans seem to rather like to have wars in Europe, where they're thousands and thousands of miles away from it, and also to sell lots of weapons. But anyway, thanks, Patricia. Final thoughts and comments about hidden agendas, things which might now suddenly pop out with this whacking great majority that Keir Starmer's got. What about you first, Don?
I, without a doubt, I think there are plans afoot or being prepared for some... As I mentioned earlier on about the infrastructural developments, principally and particularly about social housing. It's what personally I've been looking for.
That'd be lovely,
what I've been looking for from politicians since back in Thatcher's day, which is someone who's going to say, yeah, we're going to let councils build. You know, we're going to let local authorities build that as part of a package of social housing. Stop talking about affordable housing. Let's talk about social housing.
Yes, correct. I mean, keep talking about we're going to build houses. But, well, you're not, actually. You're going to allow planning permission for private house builders to build little shoeboxes that are massively overpriced. In fact, if you look at the standard of the 1940s, 50s council housing, it's way better than these houses, these private builds. So you think they might be actually building some more council houses, social housing,
I think housing associations? I think the only way, the quicker way, and it's still a long process, is to allow councils to get back to building again. Yeah, the housing market's been privatised by the Conservative Party, as has many other things. And I think that their way of socialising it, in a change Labour kind of way, would be
fingers crossed, Martin. Martin, is that feasible, do you think? Will Reeves do something like that?
So that's a positive thought, and it would be good if it happened. But I'm afraid the world situation is absolutely dire, and the hidden agenda, I'm afraid, is war.
What about constitutional reform? Because
no, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Because the years, the Labour Party have been talking a lot about reform and abolition of the House of Lords.
Yes, I know, but I mean that's the only thing that they're prepared to talk about. We'd probably need a written constitution, like in Ireland.
We need a written constitution. I agree.
But I'm afraid the Americans don't stick to theirs, do they? August is coming up. Okay, August is coming up. It's going to be every bit as dangerous as August 1914 and August 1939. And I don't think the population have really taken this on board.
We had a clip from Andrew Bridgen saying we are at war with Russia. Let me finish the sentence. Andrew Bridgen said, Conservative MP, who I imagine has been hoofed out in this general election because he wasn't a Conservative at the time of the general election, he said there is already a war going on with Russia. It's just they haven't told us yet. He said he reckoned August, September, we're going to have to tell us, and that one of the reasons that Rishi Sunak called a general election was because he didn't want to be a war prime minister. So, I mean, that's just one MP. He's in the know. Yeah. He's very independent-minded. He's stuck to his principles. He's probably almost certain, I'm not 100% sure, but I think he's out now. What do you make of that?
Martin and I were talking about this before while we were preparing for the show, as you were putting the kit together.
Waiting.
And we pretty much agreed that the Third World War has actually started. Yeah. Can I just quickly throw something back?
Sure.
Because it came up much earlier on. This country, the United Kingdom, has been, let's call it the United States of America's poodle since probably around the time of the First World War, if not sooner. Where they go, we follow. We are, and they are, the Cold War's not ended. And we are now in a hot war in so many different places.
Are our leaders really prepared to put Britain against an enemy of the Americans? Even though the Americans are sitting there rubbing their hands going, right, we're going to make some money here. Are our governments prepared to let our young people die for the Americans?
Yes, they did that. Remember the first Iraq war? Yeah, they do. Yeah,
They do.
They already do.
They're already doing it. Yeah. I mean, British special forces are clearly engaged in what's going on in the Ukraine. They have been for years. And there's the various terrorist attacks inside Russia, the Crocus pop concert and all this. The stuff I read is international analysis. I read a lot of it. The Russians are quite clear that all of that was orchestrated by MI5, MI6 and the CIA working with their jihadi allies.
What's really interesting, Martin a couple of times has mentioned the special forces. It's not even the special forces. It's the paramilitaries and the private corporations. When I lived in Bristol previously, like 10 years, I lived with a merc. And every other weekend, he was off on some adventure as a merc. This stuff has been going. This was 10 years ago. This is not.
My
their fingers are in many pies.
Yeah, that's right.
And private, they do private military companies.
Yes, and of course they're linked to the mainstream stuff.
Yeah.
Indirectly.
So when a government or a corporation wants to have a war that they can't actually get a vote on it, they will just send the mercenaries.
Well, we're already at war with Yemen without a vote of any kind. It was just an administrative decision.
The Russians have just got to suck it up, Martin, really, haven't they?
Well, no, they're not sucking it up, are they?
Yes, they are.
They've killed more than 500,000.
Well, yes, but they haven't been hitting the West, even though the West has been hitting them.
Not yet. At some point they will. That's when the British ambassador was called in and said, if you use your missiles firing at our bases in Russia, we will fire back at you in Britain. And they've got the missiles to do that. And if we wanted to fire back, we couldn't because their air defence is superior. Russia has got air superiority. Mm. They're just not using it.
So can I just leave, before the break, final comment to you, Don, on what you think the next 5 years, are we going to go 5 years? Because, I mean, it's a massive majority. It's going to be almost impossible, I think, for them to unseat it. And I wonder whether you think that the new set of Labour MPs are going to have many dissidents, because it's almost as if Starmer can do almost whatever he wants now.
He will have dissidents, but just like with Boris or Bozo, they can keep them to the side. Their majority is big enough for them to keep them to the side, so that he can get through whatever he needs to get through, because he's going to have lots of people. All these new MPs are going to be totally loyal to him.
You think housing, Martin thinks war, I think constitutional reform.
I think constitutional reform is going to be talked about, but it's going to be the second term.
Maybe.
And he will have a second term.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us, everybody. Particularly you, Don. Just tell us a little bit about you, if people are interested in seeing some of you. You're saying you're doing stand-up comedy. You're not doing that anymore, no?
I did a thing at an event in Bristol. I've been a stand-up comedian for, over 20 years. But because of my activities in Bristol originally on Nujima Radio, which is under Ofcom rules, and also working as a civil servant of sorts, I have to be balanced, so I can't really say what I really want to say.
Oh, okay, I think you've done quite well.
I'm here as Donald Mack, not in my AKA. Donald Mack is my AKA, my DJ name, my stand-up comedy name. And under that heading, then I can say I've still been not said exactly everything that I would have wanted to say, and I've also moderated my language.
You make a good politician.
There you go. Some have said that, but I wouldn't, because I don't follow an ideology, and that's the problem.
And that's good.
I won't get behind.
I think that's the best way. I honestly think that's the best way. Issue by issue.
Issue by issue. Yeah.
If you start what the political party system seems to do is corral people, and slowly shut them down, so they lose their sense of.
They tried to corral me a couple of times, and I just wouldn't have it.
Lovely.
Different parties as well.
Anyway, Donald Mack, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. I enjoyed it.
I'm on my way. I'm on my way. And I'm
don't go. On my way. Don't hinder me.
On my way.
If you don't go.
Travelling style, I'm a vagabond from Ireland's Isle. My sunburnt tongue stuck up in the air. Many is the lift from here to there. Cars, buses, vans, and trains, and the punishing heat, the snow and the rain. Oh, axel the diddle for the dire o' day. Oh, axel the diddle for the dare. Oh, Mrs. Dolan, your son, he isn't working. I came from Dublin to Jerusalem town, had a drink or two on the journey down at the railway station called Gare du Nord. Missed me train through Garglan Heart. 3 days later in Napoli, on the Turkish boat I sailed to sea. Stepped in a hot hole down below, travelling tourist class, you know. Oh, act for the diddle for the dare o' day. Oh, act for the diddle for the dare. Oh, Mrs. Dolan, your son, he isn't working. Land came in sight, and the customs man gave me a fright. How much money have you got, what's your jaw? I bluffed and said, £50 or so. He said, shalom, I said, good day. Grabbed me guitar, got fast away. Down to the desert then I went, digging up history and living in a tent. Oh, act for the diddle for the dire o' day. Oh, act for the diddle for the dare. Oh, Mrs. Dolan, your son, he isn't working. It was in the Gulf of Aqaba, I met some paddies and we had a fla. Danced through the streets of Eilat town, sang Sean south of Garryong. I was travelling, I don't know. You pack me your gear, you shove and go. You leave the crack for another bout. Could damn well do with the pint of stout. Whack, fill the diddle, fill the dare, oh day. Whack, fill the diddle, fill the dare, oh, Mrs. Dolan. Your son, he isn't working. Whack, fill the diddle, fill the dare, oh day. Whack, fill the diddle, fill the dare, oh, Mrs. Dolan. Your son, he isn't working.
When you're born suspicious,
I was born suspicious.
When I was born
suspicious.
suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
When I was born,
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious.
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
Right.
I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious. I was born suspicious.
Oh, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. This is the Gypsy edition from the corridor over the archway at the Coomber Centre. We couldn't actually get into a room, and I'll post a little picture of our makeshift studio on top of a trestle table for you later on tonight. Old Labour, he's Irish Republican Labour activist. Old Labour Oxford economist, no. Because he keeps saying that there's not enough money for this and that, where he knows there really is. And me, Tony Gosling. So with our general election out of the way, hopefully we've figured out a little bit about the new goons in power and whether the World Economic Forum or the Bilderbergers or the Trilateral Commission are really in charge of the UK. And certainly the press, in conjunction with these massive companies, have a massive influence, an enormous influence, this time by shutting out the Workers' Party from much of the TV discussion and radio and newspaper discussion and debate about things like policies like nationalisation of the water industry, which you'd have thought would be a big topic, but no. In fact, nationalisation of all of the utilities that Margaret Thatcher got rid of back in the 1980s. All these things are massively important, because otherwise, if you're voting for a government that doesn't have any control over these and doesn't properly regulate any of our infrastructure, why bother to vote? And maybe that's one of the reasons people haven't been voting. Martin, do you want to just say what you think of that? This whole idea of the government becoming actually more and more useless because there's so little they control and they're so massively in debt. They're in a debt trap, effectively, aren't they? Then the whole country is.
That's right. I mean, the whole purpose of the privatisations was to make sure that the government didn't have the necessary control to carry through industrial policy, for example. Our visitor last week from Reform clearly didn't believe in industrial policy at all. Why do we need industrial policy? The market can just do it.
This is Milton
That's not
Friedman.
The Chinese or the Russians.
This is Milton Friedman, monetarism, really, isn't it?
Hayek was his big guru.
Yeah, I know, but it's just that's been discredited. So people like him are now coming up with something else to say, I believe in this. The financial system left to its own will just kill off 90% of the population who are too poor to have any power.
Well, that's right. The financialisation, I mean, the reason why they had a financial crash in 2008 was the deregulation of the city, the Big Bang, in the 1980s. And all the regulations were put in the 1930s because of the stock market crash in 1929. And then we decided to forget about all of that and just let them go and do it all over again on a bigger scale. And that's all that's happened there. And of course, the consequences are going to be dire. The economic situation around the world is very, very, very weak. Developing countries are now in a position where they've got to, you know, you've seen these riots in Kenya because the IMF have imposed tax increases on poor people to try and pay debts.
Are they making the economy scream there?
They're making the economy scream, but of course it has screamed because there have been loads of protests and, you know, scores of people have been shot dead by the police, incidentally, who have been sent to Haiti to try and control it as part of the, you know, the Kenyan police have been bussed into Haiti to try and control it for the Americans. And of course, when big countries in Latin America default, which they may well do, then the banking system in the West will just collapse. Now, I used to think that that would then lead to a collapse in the Chinese and Russian banking system, but they work really hard to insulate themselves entirely from what will happen to us. Our capitalist system will collapse. Theirs will not. And the way the West is going to lose World War III is that we're going to go down an economic. This is what they wanted to do to the Russians, but it's going to happen to us. The Russian economy this week, the World Bank decided it was a high income economy for the first time. So they've become, you know, and the standards of living in Russia now are higher than many other countries in Europe. Meanwhile, because of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and all the stupid shenanigans, financialization that we've gone through, we are weak.
So anyway, this week, Hungary's Viktor Orban has been visiting Ukraine. He's demanding a ceasefire.
Yeah.
Seems to be one of the only people doing that. He was in Ukraine in his first wartime visit on Tuesday, suggesting the Ukraine Freedom President Volodymyr Zelensky, he should agree to a ceasefire with Russia. The so-called peace formula of Zelensky, which he's been pushing away as a way to end the war, requires full Russian withdrawal from Ukraine before negotiations. I asked the president to think about whether we could reverse the order and speed up peace talks with making a ceasefire first, Orban said at a joint press conference with the Ukrainian leader. Ceasefire connected to a deadline would give a chance to speed up peace talks. I explored this possibility with the president. I'm grateful for his honest answer and negotiation. So this is interesting, isn't it? You've got a split really going on in the West between many of these Eastern European countries who would be in the forefront of any war with Russia. And also, of course, we've got much closer language and cultural relations with the Russians than the United States and Western Europe.
Well, actually, I think the split in Europe, as I've said before on this programme, is actually a north-south split. If you look at the countries that are very iffy about going to war with Russia, they tend to be countries like Greece, Italy,
Spanish, actually.
Serbia, obviously. And the northern countries like Baltic states and Poland, where I used to go a lot, and then moving further is Germany. I mean, there's a strong groundswell against war in Germany, but the political class are determined to go to war with Russia. And of course, it's a fantasy, really, because we're already at war with Russia and we're losing. Even if we officially declared war with Russia, we can't fight because we haven't got anything to fight with.
Everything we do, we lose. Where we lost in Iraq, we lost in Afghanistan, the Americans lost in Vietnam. This is what they call a lose scenario. You go into a war knowing you're going to lose, but you will destabilize the region, which is actually the real purpose of it.
That's right. And of course, I follow Andrei Martyanov's blog called Reminiscences of the Future. He's a former Russian naval officer, and he's very good. He really does understand. I mean, he's very technical. As a naval officer, he says a lot of warfare is very, very technical. And the American generals are basically dim. They can't do the stuff that Russian generals can do because they haven't got the brain power.
It's just that. I think it's also partly to do with how these people are promoted into those positions. It's largely because they're part of a clique, they're pliable, they know that they can be relied on to obey orders and not to think for themselves.
That's
now, actually, a very successful army needs to have people who do think for themselves and are prepared. For example, when General Stalin says, I don't want you to do that, they say, well, I'm going to have to because it's the only way. They will stand up to their so-called betters and potentially risk being demobbed or dismissed for being so-called cheeky. But you can't have a successful army that just does what it's told by the people at the top.
Well, it's actually a balance between having an overall strategy that everybody buys into and allowing local initiative. But it's also, there's a lot of technical capacity involved in modern warfare.
Ego, a lot of it. Whoever's in charge, obviously, you know, whether it's the American deep state or the Kremlin, you know, the more it is about ego, the less successful this military is going to be.
Well, that's right. I mean, don't forget that the military-industrial complex in the West is basically a boondoggle jobs thing and profits for the people making the weaponry. Now, of course, the Russians inherited from the Soviet Union a nationalized arms industry. It's not run for profit of any kind. And, of course, that's exactly how they defeated the Germans in the 40s. The Germans were relying on German industrialists who wanted to make money to make their stuff. The Russians were relying on their planned economy principles. They removed all of the industry, which is in Eastern Russia, behind the Urals. It was a huge effort. And then they completely retooled themselves and threw the Germans back to Berlin. And, of course, they've learned all that history. They've got all that stuff behind them. And of course, they've had massive experience now fighting in Syria and in Ukraine. I mean, if the British Army turned up to face off with them, they would last. They wouldn't last.
I wonder how long a British general would last if he were to really raise questions about the wisdom of what's going on.
Well,
with the Russians.
Interestingly
they'd
enough,
they'd probably be elbowed out. Wouldn't
no,
they?
Interestingly enough, I went to a debate at a presentation at the Hague Festival quite a few years ago now by General Michael Rose, who had written, British Army General, who was actually the UN commander when I was in Bosnia. He basically wrote a book called Washington's War from Independence to Iraq. And the book compared the British Army's incompetence in the American War of Independence with the US's Army's incompetence in Iraq. And it was quite a pointed book.
But he didn't write that while he was a serving general.
No, he didn't.
No, exactly. So he's safe, isn't he? But this is what bothers me, is that you've got whole massive armies of maybe, tens or hundreds of thousands of people, with some, there's just little sycophants in charge. And this reminds me a little bit about Boy Browning and, my book about the Second World War and the Battle of Arnhem, where you've got somebody who's sent in there, effectively, even though no one's officially saying it, except those people who mention that he might be or elbowed out, to actually throw the fight.
Well, yes. I mean, if you've got people who are in there deliberately to throw the fight, then that's because there's a lot more goes on here than we realise.
Isn't it about economics largely? A lot of this warfare, it's whether it's money for the arms companies or it's about taking resources, resources.
Isn't it interesting that the guy Belousov, who's been appointed as the Minister of Defence instead of Shoigu, is in fact a technocratic economist. He's an economist, and therefore he's going to streamline everything they're doing. What they want to do is use their military industry as a way to create spin-offs into private sector profit making. But the military stuff will remain non-profit. That's exactly what the model, the Keynesian model of military Keynesianism would be. But what's happened in the West is it's become more important that the companies producing this stuff make money than winning the war. And of course, in that case, you're going to lose. So we can't produce loads more shells because the companies that would produce them can't make money producing those shells. So they don't want to do it. Whereas in Russia, they just say, produce more shells. Go off. Get on with it.
So I think one of the big bits of news this week is, mentioned it briefly earlier, Israeli generals want a truce in Gaza, putting them at odds with Netanyahu. Israel's top generals want to have a ceasefire in Gaza, even if it keeps Hamas in power. Well, I mean, they're not doing very well in getting rid of Hamas. Of course, this is they're setting themselves up to fail, and maybe they know that's exactly what they're doing. The top generals are at odds with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, says the New York Times on Wednesday. The report, which cited current and former security officials, said one reason Israel's top brass favoured a pause in Gaza was so Israeli military could recuperate to prepare to what might be a full-blown war against Hezbollah in Lebanon. They also believe a ceasefire in Gaza could reduce tensions on the Israel-Lebanon border, make it easier to reach a deal with the Lebanese. Though Israeli Defence Minister Yoav Gallant has previously said a pause in Gaza would mean escalation in Lebanon. The Israeli military also believe a deal with Hamas is the best way to safely free the remaining Israeli hostages. The military are in full support of a hostage deal and a ceasefire, former Israeli National Security Advisor Eyal Hualata told the New York Times. Well, this is kind of what we were talking about just now, isn't it? You've got a bunch of generals who are just saying to Netanyahu, look, this is ridiculous. Even though you're prime minister and in power, we're having to do this, and we think it's insane.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is one of the hopes that I have, is that really serious professional military know the score, and they know who's going to win any battle, and therefore they're actually quite, they know that they by mutual respect we can resolve this. The Israeli military basically say, well, we've got to talk to Hamas. They're look how good they are at fighting. we're running out of options.
Well, the UN is saying 1.9 million Palestinians have now been displaced in Gaza. Also that the hospital director, one of the last hospital directors, is saying newborn babies now have only a tiny chance of survival in Gaza.
Well, that's right, and that's going to be playing out on people's TV screens as we go through the summer.
Is it? Is it? I wonder, because, I mean, a lot of this stuff isn't getting talked about. The chances of a newborn baby surviving in Gaza are not good. In the malnutrition ward at the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, babies are only days old and often premature. They're fighting for their lives. Mothers are so malnourished themselves, they cannot breastfeed, so babies are dying, literally starving to death. They cannot get vital nutrition a newborn's need. Within 2 weeks, we detected more than 250 patients of malnutrition, explains Dr. Hassan Abu Safar, the hospital's director. This was all detected in one hospital, our hospital, which means the number will most likely increase in the coming days. We ask the world, please, to allow the entry of food and allow the entry of clean water.
Well, you know, the world community has been screaming for this for quite a while. Whether it will, you know, we need a ceasefire. I mean, if the Israeli generals manage to persuade or strong-arm Netanyahu into having a ceasefire, the whole world will cheer. But I don't see it. I don't see it.
The US Foreign Affairs magazine has confirmed this week that Hamas is stronger today than it was on October the 7th. Its cause is more popular and its appeal is stronger than before the 7th of October. The magazine wrote in a report, after 9 months of grueling war, it's time to recognise the stark reality. There's no military-only solution to defeat Hamas, adding that Hamas is neither defeated nor on the verge of defeat, nor even on the wane. It noted Israel has invaded northern and southern Gaza with 40,000 combat troops, forcibly displaced 80% of the population, killed over 37,000 people, dropped 70,000 tons of bombs on the territory, surpassing the combined weight of bombs dropped on London, Dresden and Hamburg in all of World War II. It's destroyed or damaged over half of all the buildings, limited the territory's access to water, food and electricity, leaving the entire population on the brink of famine. The magazine also says that although many observers have highlighted the immorality of Israel's conduct, Israeli leaders have consistently claimed the goal of defeating Hamas and weakening its ability to launch new attacks. The punishment of the population of Gaza must be accepted as necessary to destroy the power of Hamas. But actually, the reality is, and the Foreign Affairs magazine, this is, I think, isn't it part of the Council on Foreign Relations?
It probably is.
They're saying that Hamas is stronger today than it was on October the 7th. So,
well, there
this
we
is
are.
Complete nonsense, this whole idea of, you know, Hamas is winning, they're saying.
Well, they are, because if you're an insurgent, you win by not losing. Whereas if you're the occupier, you have to defeat the insurgency. And otherwise you've lost. And they haven't defeated the insurgency, so the Israelis are already beaten in Gaza. And some of the fools in the cabinet, so, well, we can't win in Gaza, let's have a go in Lebanon.
Okay, so this is echoing what we were talking about with Ukraine, isn't it?
Really? Yeah.
What motivates these people to carry on fighting when they know they are going to lose and are losing already? And the military are telling them, oh, we've got to stop, we've got to stop. They keep going.
Well, because they're not entirely rational. Don't presume that people always make rational choices, because it's quite clear that they don't. Ideology can even blind people to reality. I mean, we'll just have to see how this plays out. It's an incredibly dangerous moment. You know,
it has to stop, doesn't it? Maybe they can't carry on. They're going to
lose.
Well,
no, what they'll do is they'll carry on and then the house will come down on their heads, and it'll come down on all our heads. That's the trouble.
Well, one reason that we keep hearing about why we have to fight the Russians, going back to that side of the equation, is the Skripals, and we keep being told this, don't we? The British government, though, I think maybe you sent me this, Martin.
I did.
The British government is inventing phantom Skripals to refuse to testify. What on earth is going on there?
Well, I'd read the article quite a while ago, so I can't remember all the details, but there's an inquiry going on into what happened in the Skripal affair, and the Skripals, you know, if it's an inquiry, they ought to testify. But the British government are saying they can't testify because it's a threat to their safety or whatever, and it's not even clear that they're in contact with the Skripals.
Well, they can have a lawyer represent them, surely.
No, there isn't body. There isn't none.
A new lawyer appeared in London claiming to represent Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal. His name's Jack Holborn, as in tobacco, old Holborn tobacco, a barrister specialising in what he calls human rights. He told Lord Anthony Hughes, who's conducting the public inquiry into the Novichok death of Dawn Sturgis in 2018, the Skripals should not be called to give evidence or testify in the case. Holborn claimed the Skripals are fearful for their security. No security measures are perfect, he said. Holborn has not been in contact with the Skripals. However, he refuses to answer questions put to him on what visual contact or other communications he's had with either of them.
Well, the Russians believe that they're dead and that we killed them. And people in Britain don't believe we do things like that. And the answer is, we do. Ask anybody in Belfast.
There was a couple of things we mentioned last week, which are the fact that Yulia was involved in all of this. She shouldn't have been a target. Why was she a target? Maybe she just knew what her dad knew. It seems to me that they wanted to get rid of him. He knew a lot about the British intelligence's sexing up of the... Well, it wasn't actually, was it the Trump dossier? I think it was. By Christopher Steele, and the idea that the British intelligence are making up massive news stories in order to try and make sure particular politicians are or are not elected. Skripal knew all about this, but he was also trying to go back to Russia. He said he wanted to go back. He'd had enough of Britain and to see if he could get a pardon from Putin, who apparently was prepared to give him one. So those guys that came over, rather than trying to kill him with Novichok, were possibly just bringing him and Yulia a couple of passports to get back to Russia.
Well, that aspect of it, I mean... This is all quite... People don't believe that the Western intelligence services do things like this, but my research and experience over many years, they do. They create... Don't forget that the World Cup was being played in Russia that summer. Yeah, the Russians had invited people from all over the world to come and see the new Russia, have a good time, watch some football...
This is a joke. This lawyer hasn't even spoken to
them.
That's
right. He admitted
so he knows. Who is he representing? He can't represent them if he's never spoken to
them. Well, that's right. What he is a front man for the British government.
This is quite a nice article you sent me, because it winds up. The problem for the British government is if the Skripals are allowed to give live evidence at the Hughes inquiry, there is no telling what they may say to contradict or discredit the 6-year official narrative of the Russian Novichok attack in England. So they may say something like, well, actually, we really just wanted to get out of the country and these guys didn't try and kill us and no one tried to poison us. There's all sorts of things they could say.
That's right. Well, I mean, what the Russians suspect is that they are dead. Don't forget, Yulia Skripal came to visit her father and was going home to get married. Yeah. And her fiancé has had no contact with her.
God, it's just quite unbelievable, isn't it, really, the extent to which the... I mean, this is the lies coming back to haunt the people that told them.
Well, it is, but most people, if you talk to them, still think that Putin tried to poison them, which is absurd. There was no motive, means or opportunity. Meanwhile, Putin down just up the road. I mean, Dilyana Gatasheva, before she retired from journalism, had showed that there was no chain of custody for the Novichok... there has to be a chain of custody before you can claim anything about these things. There was no chain of custody. And the other thing there's no chain of custody and, the story basically is made up. Western powers engage in these, you know, they see themselves as extremely clever manipulators of public opinion.
Okay, so let's look at Skripals, for example. There was a problem here. This guy wanted to go back to Russia. He could be all over the TV, all over the world, dishing the dirt on what MI6 had been up to try and make sure Donald Trump wasn't elected. They don't want this, but they're saying, well, how can we turn this to our advantage? Oh, we could just make up a silly story to do with it all.
And also, don't forget...
The empire of lies, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, they the are. And don't forget, lies. As I said earlier, Russia was just on a bit of a roll. They're about to host the World Cup, which went off successfully, but of course, you know, because of the Skripals, of course the Russians aren't allowed to play in the World Cup now. They're not going to be at the Olympics. They've been kicked out of all of these things because the evil Putin invaded Ukraine and he poisoned Skripal and so on. Dawn Sturges was deliberately poisoned by our intelligence services because she was a rubbish person, an ex addict or whatever, and she was just worth throwing under the bus to make Putin look bad. This is my honest view. Berezovsky, who I have mentioned quite frequently on these shows, who was Putin's, Putin was his right-hand man when he first came to power, and they fell out because Berezovsky wanted Putin to carry on the privatization program and he didn't want to. He died of suicide, supposedly, in Surrey. I can't remember when it was, some years ago now. And the coroner wouldn't sign it off as suicide because he said, well, you know, this doesn't stack up. This isn't suicide.
Well, one of the things we have...
He wasn't murdered by the Russians. He was murdered by our people.
This show is kind of homeless at the moment, which is why we're broadcasting from a corridor over the arch of the Cumber Centre. So we've missed a few things. This sort of set me out of my stride a little bit, and us generally. But, Martin, one of the quite important things that's happened since is the attack in Dagestan, attacks on police posts, churches and a synagogue in Russia's North Caucasus Republic, Dagestan, left 20 people dead, most of them police officers. 5 gunmen were killed, 46 people taken to hospital with injuries after attack Sunday evening a couple of weeks ago. 3 days of mourning have been declared in Dagestan. Apparently coordinated attacks targeted the cities of Derbent and Makhachkala on the Orthodox festival of Pentecost, with the Orthodox priest among those killed. So what's going on here?
Well, the stuff I've been reading, the Russian secret services are pretty much convinced. I mean, don't forget that the Western intelligence services were behind both Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and the Russians know all about it. Western public opinion goes, no, 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 no. But, of course, the FSB know all about these things. That's their job. That's one of the reasons why the Russians are so relentlessly hostile, because they know that they're being targeted. And, of course, the other thing that happened is an American missile, which must have been directed by Americans, fired by Americans, directed by global, you know, the ISIS.
Sevastopol,
you think? Yeah, they fired at a beach, killing, you know, potentially it was shot down before it reached the beach, but the cluster bomb still fell on people. And if they'd succeeded, of course, they could have killed hundreds of people like that. The Ukrainians are losing the war, and therefore the British Special Forces and intelligence services are advising them to turn to terrorism. What they're trying to do is create... you look at the response that you see in the Western media. It's very revealing. They say, what these attacks show is that Putin can't protect his own people, and therefore they're going to rise up and remove him. Now, this is fantasy, but it just shows how wicked they are. But if you think about the 9/11 attacks, the bombings of Boulogne railway station in 1980, it's all absolutely consistent with NATO intelligence operations, which are terroristic. And the Russians are very well aware of that, and they're fed up with it.
So who are these people doing these attacks?
It's claimed to be ISIS-K, ISIS Khorasan, who are based in northern Afghanistan. But the Taliban don't like them. They don't want them there. And they are, in fact, regarded by the intelligence services of all the of anybody. If you follow what goes on in the real world of intelligence, they're all regarded as Western puppets of MI6 and CIA. So our tax pounds are being used to finance these terrorist attacks. But it's not a surprise to people who regularly listen to this show, because the bombings in London on 7/7.
How do they convince people to go and do these attacks when they're likely to get killed themselves?
No, but don't forget, unlike most jihadi attacks, they carry out the attacks and ran away. Yeah. A proper jihadi attack, they expect. In any case, you saw the people who carried out the Crocus attack, they managed to capture them. They're trying to flee to the Ukraine. You know, they're not from the Ukraine, but that's where they're fleeing to. That rather suggests that's what's behind it, doesn't it?
Covert Action magazine is something that's well worth taking out, one of their little free email subscriptions. I'm not sure if they have a real printed magazine anymore. They certainly used to. It was started by the former CIA officer Philip Agee many, many years ago, probably there's in the 1970s. But Covert Action magazine is really one of the best in the world, certainly one of the best newsletters in the United, comes out of the United States. One of their articles this week piqued my interest. It says, intelligence services have penetrated and corrupted human rights NGOs, says former senior lawyer with the Office of the UN High Commission. On April the 7th, 2022, the UN General Assembly voted to exclude Russia from the UN Human Rights Council. The resolution received the required two-thirds majority of those voting, minus abstentions in the 193-member assembly, with 93 nations voting in favour and 24 against. The vote was highly politicised, reflected the success of the Western information war against Russia, which was falsely blamed for launching an unprovoked invasion of Ukraine and for committing the overwhelming majority of atrocities in the War. So that's the background to all of this. But Alfred de Zayas, a former senior lawyer with the Office of the UN High Commission, he's wrote in his book, The Human Rights Industry, that the UN General Assembly's decision to exclude Russia added to the general atmosphere of Russophobia we've seen over the last three decades, to the world's perception of engineered bias in the UN itself, where the manipulation of states' votes was enabled by a failure to call for a secret ballot, as requested by the Russians. De Zayas noted further that if exclusion were undertaken objectively by the General Assembly, one would expect the exclusion of other offenders, including several NATO countries, for war crimes against humanity and crimes against humanity committed by their forces during the wars of aggression against Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya and Syria, Saudi Arabia, because of the genocidal war against the people of Yemen and because of the gruesome assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, India for its systematic war crimes and gross violations of human rights against the people of Kashmir, including extrajudicial executions that they're doing there, Azerbaijan, because its aggression against the hapless Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh, decades of systematic killing of human rights defenders, social leaders, syndicalists and indigenous peoples by Colombian governments and lethal paramilitary force. So it's interesting that but only the Russians have actually been excluded, never mind all the rest of those people doing all those things.
Well, that's right, because there's no even-handedness in any of this, is there? But, you know, there's been a lot of change in very recent times in the geopolitical configuration of the world.
The UN is failing, really. I mean, we have to say. I mean, in a way, that's what he's saying. Because, I mean, you look at, for example, the 1.9 million Gazans that have been displaced. Imagine if you had a city the size of Birmingham, must be roughly 2-3 million people displaced. I mean, what the British wouldn't take that lying down, would they?
No, well, the UN is a very flawed institution. But I think the Russian-Chinese view is all we've got, but we're not necessarily going to kowtow to your version of what international law is. That's why the West doesn't use the term international law. That's why they refer to the rules-based order, because a lot of what they've done is absolutely in defiance of international law. And Putin, amongst many of his other talents, is a top-level lawyer. So he knows about all this stuff, and he's very careful to make sure that he stays within international law, whereas the West accuses him of this, that, and the other. But he's turning around to the South Africans, to the people in Africa, to the people in the developing world, saying, look, they're the ones breaking the law. You know they are. And of course, the whole world knows it's the US, which is the biggest lawbreaker. That, you know, they are the poison in the system, with us yapping along at their heels. And the rest of the world is wising up to this. It's a very big change.
News report, which I found rather fascinating, BlackRock and Wall Street, they are profiting from Israel's crimes in Gaza. And this is the UN also now. So, we sort of love the UN really here. Because we've got, you know, and so this is a report from the UN about BlackRock and Wall Street making a lot of money out of the, they say Israel's crimes. It's just a genocide in Gaza.
Top UN human rights experts have stated very clearly that Israel is committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza, and that foreign governments supporting Israel can be complicit in these crimes. And in particular, top UN legal experts have called on foreign states to stop giving weapons to Israel. And they've gone further and stated that Western weapons corporations can be considered complicit in these crimes that Israel is committing. And they added that major Western banks on Wall Street and asset management firms like BlackRock, they named BlackRock specifically, along with U.S. banks like J.P. Morgan and Bank of America. According to UN human rights experts, these Western financial institutions can also be considered complicit in the war crimes that Israel is committing in Gaza and are profiting from those war crimes. This was made very clear in a statement that was published by the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, titled, "States and Companies Must End Arms Transfers to Israel Immediately or Risk Responsibility for Human Rights Violations," according to UN experts. I'm going to read a few clips from this document because it names some of the Western companies that are complicit in these war crimes and are profiting. Now, it states, the transfer of weapons and ammunition to Israel may constitute serious violations of human rights and international humanitarian laws and risk state complicity in international crimes, possibly including the G-side crime, which I don't say because this will be censored. This is according to UN experts, and they reiterated their demand to stop arms transfers immediately. They noted that the UN Human Rights Council and independent UN experts have stated that Israel is committing war crimes. And in particular, they say that these are some of the Western companies that are supplying Israel with military equipment. BAE Systems, Boeing, Caterpillar, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Oshkosh, Rheinmetall, Rolls-Royce Power Systems, RTX, and ThyssenKrupp. These companies must end their transfers to Israel. Research shows that the vast majority of weapon shipments to Israel come from the U.S., 66%, but Germany also provides 30% of the weapons that go to Israel, and Italy provides another 5% of the weapons that go to Israel. So the U.S., Germany, and Italy have been arming Israel. While naming these Western companies as complicit in arming Israel, the UN human rights experts emphasized that the International Court of Justice at The Hague ordered Israel to immediately halt its military offensive in Rafah in Gaza, where roughly 1 million civilians were trapped. Israel completely ignored that ruling by The Hague, violating it. And The Hague also stated that the G-side crime can be a plausible risk. Furthermore, the UN human rights experts stressed that the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has sought arrest warrants against Israeli leaders over war crimes and crimes against humanity. The ICC applied for arrest warrants against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant.
So, not sure of the actual reporter there, but Martin, this is, you know, I find it interesting when people do this, which is name all these companies that are actually potentially, supporting these war crimes. I mean, you've got the rule, you know, the rule of law should mean something. It seems to be meaning less and less and less. And these companies are, if they're complicit, which they are in war crimes, then they should be shut down or prosecuted. The directors prosecuted, their premises taken over.
Well, that's what should happen. As we know, that's not that.
Apart from Palestine Action, they're doing it.
Well, that's right. But I mean, the point is that all these, you know, once you start looking into it, all of the people, companies and so on that are complicit in what's going on in Gaza, they are a target. And of course, what Palestine Action has done is various companies have got in contact with Palestine Action and said, we've cancelled that order, because we don't want you coming round it.
Another person that's been talking quite a bit, this time I do know his name, is Chris Hedges. He's had an absolutely amazing, quite a long speech about what's been going on. Do you want to say a little bit about him? Because he's been around for a long time. He was reporting, I think, on the conflicts over in Eastern Europe, Iraq, Afghanistan, all these sort of things, ever since, well, the 1990s, probably, where you were in former Yugoslavia too.
Well, he's been all over the place because he used to be an international correspondent, was it from the New York Times or something, one of the big ones. Mm. But of course, he's been blackballed because of his views. He used to have a mainstream platform, like Seymour Hurst.
We love people
just,
like that.
They've just got rid of him and say, you can't be on our platform.
Everyone
anymore.
That gets blackballed, you're going to come out with that ends up pretty quickly in our little pocket here on our show. So anyway, here's Chris Hedges talking about what he talks about, the soul of the Israeli nation.
Israel's cultural, artistic, journalistic, and intellectual life will be exterminated. Israel will be a stagnant nation where the religious fanatics, bigots, and Jewish extremists who have seized power will dominate public discourse. It will join the club of the globe's most despotic regimes. Despotisms can exist long after their past due date, but they're terminal. You don't have to be a biblical scholar to see that Israel's lust for rivers of blood is antithetical to the core values of Judaism. The cynical weaponization of the Holocaust including branding Palestinians as Nazis, has little efficacy when you carry out a live-streamed genocide against 2.3 million people trapped in a concentration camp. Nations need more than force to survive. They need a mystique. This mystique provides purpose, civility, and even nobility to inspire citizens to sacrifice for the nation. The mystique offers hope for the future. It provides meaning. It provides national identity. When mystiques implode, when they are exposed as lies, a central foundation of state power collapses. I reported on the death of the communist regimes in 1989 during the revolutions in East Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. The police and military decided there was nothing left to defend, and Israel's decay will engender the same lassitude and apathy. It will not be able to recruit indigenous collaborators such as Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, reviled by most Palestinians, to do the bidding of the colonizers. All Israel has left is escalating savagery, including torture and lethal violence against unarmed civilians, which accelerates the decline. This wholesale violence works in the short term, as it did in the war waged by the French in Algeria, the dirty war waged by Argentina's military dictatorship, the British occupation of India, Egypt, Kenya, Northern Ireland, and the American occupations of Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. But in the long term, it is suicidal. The genocide in Gaza has turned Hamas resistance fighters into heroes in the global south. And Israel may wipe out the Hamas leadership, but the past and current assassinations of scores of Palestinian leaders has done little to blunt the resistance. The genocide in Gaza has produced a new generation of deeply traumatized and enraged young men and women whose families have been killed and whose communities have been obliterated. They are prepared to take the place of martyred leaders. Israel was at war with itself before October 7th. Israelis were protesting to prevent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's abolition of judicial independence. Its religious bigots and fanatics currently in power had mounted a determined attack on Israeli secularism. Israel's unity is a negative unity. It is held together by hatred. And even this hatred is not enough to keep protesters from decrying the government's abandonment of Israeli hostages in Gaza. Hatred is a dangerous political commodity. The Palestinian, quote-unquote, human animals, when eradicated or subdued, will be replaced by Jewish apostates and traitors. A politics of hatred creates a permanent instability exploited by those seeking the destruction of civil society. And Israel was far down this road on October 7th when it promulgated a series of discriminatory laws against non-Jews that resemble the racist Nuremberg laws that disenfranchised Jews in Nazi Germany.
So that's Chris Hedges there. A longer version of that will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, talking really about the end of the all Israeli credibility, Martin. But they don't really seem to care, do they? They've got nuclear weapons. They've got a government in power that is run by a criminal that's managed to keep out of jail so far. Netanyahu is going to do everything he can to keep. And, of course, he's got this massive lobby around the world protecting him and helping him.
That's right. But, of course, what's now happened is in northern Israel, thousands and thousands of people have had to be removed because of what's going on the border there. And if it comes to war, I believe that Hezbollah are thinking of taking territory inside Israel, yeah, not just defending themselves. Because, of course, Those settlers, they're way outside.
Golan Heights is in Syria, isn't it? Isn't that in the eastern, northeastern Israel?
Well, it's the Golan Heights abuts to the Lebanon, you know.
Oh, right, okay.
So in other words...
Maybe the Lebanese could take the Golan Heights.
Well, that's right. But I mean, the thing is that the what's happened now is what Israel have done is they've brought into question the existence of the state at all, and certainly within the borders that it has now. Yeah. Now, I know, the Americans have recognized the annexation of the Golan Heights. Nobody else has. And Miriam Adelson, who's a big donor to the Republican Party in the US, she said she'll give $100 million to Trump if he allows the complete ethnic cleansing and occupation of the West Bank. Now, they are determined to try and expend the state of Israel. Smotrich and all these other people have seen their stuff this week. They're even in this chaotic moment, they see this as an opportunity to expand the state of Israel, get rid of the Palestinians. But militarily, they are not in a position to do so because their technology and their way of fighting is a 1970s way of fighting. We're now fighting in 2024.
They won't win. Don Mack, who was here earlier, was saying that his daughter is quite friendly and has done, backing vocals or that sort of thing with Loki. Loki is obviously a rapper, he's a singer. And he's also very, very politicised. He's an extremely knowledgeable chap, and he's not afraid to talk about that sort of thing. So it was out this week. It's called NATO, Israel, and the American Empire. Here is what Loki had to say on a couple of issues. One is the murder of Harry Dunn, and this is the guy who a year and a half ago or so was run down by a CIA person who'd come out of an American base here in Britain and just started driving down the wrong side of the road and killed him. But also about Sky News and how close they are to NATO.
What also happens, in addition to the invisibilizing of 12,000 soldiers on what is quite a small landmass, is also the amazing case of a teenage British citizen by the name Harry Dunn, who was on his bike when a car came out of a US base driving on the wrong side of the road. Inside the car was Ansar Kulas, what has now been revealed to be a CIA agent on British soil. She drove the car into Harry Dunn and killed him. Right. Now, what happened next is very illustrative of the relationship between Britain and the United States. You had an individual within the British Foreign Office text Sakulas that it was best to leave the country as soon as possible. And so within about 48 hours, Ansar Kulas was on a plane to the United States. And since then, the family of Harry Dunn have been doing everything they can to try and extract some form of some semblance of justice from this intransigent system. And what you actually saw happen was at one point Trump invite the family of Harry Dunn to the White House to talk to them about the case, the killing of their son. And do you know what happened? Trump said to them, you know she's next door. You know that Ansar Kulas is next door. Can you meet her? Right? So in a way, all of that, it illustrates a few things. Number one, Britain works for the United States within British borders. Yeah? It facilitates. That's what part of Five Eyes membership is. That's what it denotes. It facilitates the spying of its own population for the United States. It facilitates that process. But in this case of Harry Dunn, what you actually have is British attempts to protect the killers of a British citizen.
Why?
Because the relationship is so uneven and imbalanced. Simultaneous to the NATO occupation of Afghanistan, which rendered Afghans statistically the saddest people in the world. You had the deputy head of foreign affairs at Sky News simultaneously. No, she was the head of foreign affairs, the head foreign correspondent at Sky News, simultaneously an advisor to the deputy commander of NATO. At what point, you know, we have to begin to talk about this as, at what point does British, Israeli and US intelligence begin and end? It's a trilateral security state, and the media, which we rely on for a lot of our information, is an attachment of it.
Martin?
Well, I mean, that's pretty accurate description, isn't it? Don't forget, Sky News is owned by Murdoch.
No, it's not anymore. Well, it was.
It was.
Sky News Australia is, Fox News is. Right. Sky is now Comcast, which is an American company.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that the as you know, they put a great deal of emphasis in the deep state on psychological warfare, which is basically controlling people's narratives. You know, so this is how they do it. We're bombarded. I mean, the modern propaganda system is far more sophisticated than anything in the 1930s, you know. It functions on every possible level. And they've got people tapping away on keyboards. They've got all sorts of things going on to keep everybody stupid, to fill their minds with rubbish.
Anyway, one of our favourite people in the whole world is Michael Hudson. He's been saying quite a lot this week as well. This one out yesterday. This is about Russia and China crushing NATO's plan in Ukraine, and Ukraine is falling apart because Russia and China have taken a stance against what the West is trying to do there. And he says the Russians and Chinese are winning. In fact, the longer this goes on, the more they win. Anyway, let's have a listen to this. Michael Hudson, the economist, I just find him brilliant to listen to. I think he's actually based in China, but he's an American, isn't he?
No, I'm not quite sure where he is at the moment. I think he's in America.
He teaches in Chinese universities.
He's quite an interesting character because he's,
He believes in what we believe in, which is a mixed economy, where the government actually runs the infrastructure at cost.
Yes.
And that's one of the reasons, the fact we're not doing that since Thatcherism is one of the reasons why Britain can't compete on the world scene, which is the main reason why we're at war in these various places, because we can't compete and we don't like it when people can compete and they're more successful than we are. Anyway, Michael Hudson.
The socialist parties, when they moved to the right wing of the spectrum, became internationalists. A lot of this was the result of World War II, and it's been happening for 75 years. Many of the liberals thought that what caused World War II was nationalism. What's the alternative to nationalism? Internationalism. So they all thought that joining Europe together would end European war, and if you could have an international world economy, that would end war. What they didn't realize is that the international world economy has become unipolar, dominated by the United States, and the United States is nationalist. So what you have is an internationalist economy that is dominated by the United States and its own national interests against other countries. And its national interests believe that it can only consolidate its power by preventing any other country from acting independently of the United States. And even if they don't act actively against American trade policy or financial policy, the very potential of them for being independent is looked at as a deadly risk for them. And so the United States is engaged in regime change. It's put 800 military bases across the world to prevent all this. Well, the effect of all this has been to drive the rest of the world together. And it looks like it's creating a new international order by the BRICS, by the 85% of the world population. And what you're seeing now is in response to the United States' drive to control the world in its own interest. It's driven Russia, China, and Iran together, first of all, by creating the the military alliance, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and then by expanding into the BRICS. And now you're seeing already every month far-reaching changes. You've just seen President Putin go to Vietnam and North Korea, trying to consolidate all of Eurasia into an independent entity, an independent international group, along with the global South, that will create basically a whole set of new institutions to what the U.S. economic order was. And you have the speeches of President Putin, Lavrov, and other Russian officials saying the United Nations is now unfortunately being blocked and controlled by the United States. We need a new United Nations. Putin said that there's still going to be the old United Nations. We can leave that there to lumber along, but we're going to need a new group representing the nations that are free of United States veto power in them. They're going to need a new International Monetary Fund with an idea of economic stability and financial stability that does not involve austerity planning and anti-labor policies, and that does not believe that the way to maximize economic growth is to reduce living standards, reduce wages, and squeeze more out of labor, but to increase living standards to make labor more productive. That's how Britain, the United States, Germany, France, all the other countries developed. And now you're having the former colonial areas of the world reinvent the wheel by doing essentially what the Western economies did. And to do that, they have to be free of the Western economy's political domination, military domination, and above all, the financial legacy of international debt.
That's Michael Hudson. Martin, he just seems to describe these things. It's almost like from the moon. This is what's really going on, folks. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about him on the mainstream, well, by him on the mainstream press. But he's really there saying, we're part of a dying, doomed empire run by a bunch of idiots.
And psychopaths. Well, yes. And the good news is that the baddies are going to lose World War III unless we all die in a nuclear holocaust. Because they've been outplayed and outthought. And, you know, it's checkmate in Ukraine. And it's also going to be checkmate in Israel. Well, because they haven't defeated Hamas, never mind Hezbollah, never mind the Syrian Arab Army, never mind the Iranians, they're not going to win.
Quite a long way through that. It's brilliant. I'll put that up on our show page at this week, the full version, .org.uk. Finally, though, this week, we're finishing by looking at... It's an edit of a piece that I used... back a few months ago at Easter, which is looking at God in number 10, because Keir Starmer is the first atheist we've had in number 10.
I don't know that you said he's an atheist.
Yeah, well, you don't know, but everyone else does who pays attention. Maybe you don't want him to be an atheist.
Well, I mean, his wife's Jewish.
So, what's he? It doesn't matter.
Well, I don't know. I didn't know that he'd said he was an atheist.
Yeah, well, there we go. We don't know everything on this show, folks. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a guy called Father Mark Vickers, who's written about all this sort of thing. His book is God in Number 10.
Mr. Sunak is, of course, the first practicing Hindu prime minister in British history. And he has discussed how important his faith is in his life.
I'm a proud Hindu, and that's how I was raised, that's how I am. Having faith to give you resilience, to give you strength is important, and it provides an outlook on life which I find particularly valuable.
The majority of prime ministers, though, have been avowed Christians. Here are just a few examples.
I believe that by taking together these key elements from the Old and New Testaments, we gain a view of the universe, a proper attitude to work, and principles to shape economic and social life.
In this new world, how religious faith develops will have a profound impact.
This is a Christian country. Yes, we're a nation that embraces, welcomes and accepts all faiths and none, but we're still a Christian country.
Our Christian heritage is something we can all be proud of.
Tony Blair, he held off converting to Catholicism from Anglicanism until after he left Downing Street. He actually had Protestant Northern Irish antecedents, grandparents.
Yeah, and people don't realise that, so they assume that he's rather posh Anglo-Scots. In fact, he's half English and half Protestant Irish, and so his mother's family were farmers from County Donegal, deeply, deeply Protestant. His grandfather was in charge of the local Orange Lodge. His grandmother made him promise not to marry a Catholic. And I wonder, Tony Blair was a curious mixture of rebel and conformist. And I just wonder whether he didn't get a slight kick out of the fact when he became a Catholic, how the reaction of his Irish Protestant antecedents and his own atheist father.
And looking ahead, or speculating rather, what do we know about Keir Starmer and God?
Well, we know because he made a statement, I think 3 years ago, that he is an atheist. And if he's elected in the next few months, then he would be the first avowed atheist in Downing Street.
So where would that leave him in participating in national church services? Would that make him a hypocrite?
No, I don't think so. We have plenty of people in the church here, Sunday by Sunday, who aren't Catholics. Everyone is welcome, and obviously they should participate to the extent to which they feel comfortable. My concern isn't so much that you have an atheist, a non-believer in Downing Street. It's what's their level of theological literacy, and I think that's where things have changed over the last two or three generations. Even those who had a weak faith or no faith in the past, you could have a conversation with them. So people like Clement Attlee, they knew what Christianity was about, they knew what mattered to the church, and you could have a constructive dialogue. The problem today is whether people think of themselves as Christian or not, and it's not just limited to non-believers. The theological understanding is much, much diminished, and that's problematic.
It's interesting, isn't it? Keir Starmer says he's an atheist, yet at home he also says his family observe some Jewish traditions because his wife is Jewish.
Yeah, and he said he's very respectful of faith, if that's the case, then there oughtn't to be a problem.
Yeah, so that is Father Mark Vickers, author of God in Number 10, making it quite clear he's an avowed atheist. Obviously, he probably wants to avoid the subject, just like Tony Blair wanted to avoid the subject of God when he launched the illegal war in Iraq. Rather nice that Jeremy Paxman did hold his feet to the fire there. This is one of the things that one of the reasons why we may see. For example, getting rid of the bishops from the House of Lords, if someone like Starmer in charge, people that have been wanting to do that for a long, long time, may get their opportunity. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to Donald Mack, the local journalist and commentator, apparently on other radio stations too, you can find him. Also to a stalwart sound engineer, particularly brilliant, putting this studio together on a trestle table in a corridor in the Coomber Centre over the arch tonight, Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Thanks, by the way. Look, some of those clips at the, for example, the Hudson and the Chris Hedges one sent in by listeners this week. Do please send me interviews and story tips. You can do that via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links on the comment page, and our email address is there. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter, and you can, if you can afford it, you can donate or even set up a small monthly sub app. This week, one word, .org.uk. I'm shadowbanned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We've been streaming live from the Coomber Community Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend away from the Empire of Lies. But do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5 or thereabouts. Hopefully we'll be, we have at least a good chance of being somewhere a little bit more stable next week, thank God. And God bless you. But don't let those satanic banksters get you down.
my father was a shepherd, kept sheep all on the hill. And my mama was a vixen that he found in the corner of a field. And they call me the wild man of the hills. I was up all night, crouching on your windowsill, with my face pressed against the pane. Then I was off in the driving rain. I come down to the valley when the stars are in the sky. I hunt around the farms and fields for things that run and fly. They call me the wild man of the hills. I rob the hens from the coops and the whiskey from the stills. Then I'm up in the morning dew before the sound of the cock crow. Shepherd, he kept sheep all on the hill. Mama was a vixen that he found in the corner of the field. And they call me the wild man of the hills. I was up all night, crouching on your windowsill, with my face pressed against the pane. Then I was off in the driving rain.
I don't really believe that either of them, you know, spent the whole night crouching on somebody's windowsill. It just doesn't sound feasible. Nobody in their right mind would do anything like that. That's Bob Pegg and Nick Strutt and the Wild Man of the Hill.
There are some people who talk and some people who don't, which means that there are some people who leave this place and some who do not leave. You are obviously staying.
Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I know too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth has the village, yes.
That is my hope. What's yours?
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
We'll be right back.
Planet Dog Records. This is Eat Static and Lost in Time. Almost got to